second time this year, start our engagement in preparation for the year. For the committee's approval of the budget, which takes place on the 29th of May, I beg your pardon. So between now and the 29th of May, the committee will be seized with trying to make sense of information that has informed the department on lobbying for and succeeding in getting 18.7 billion rand of the national facility. So we want to make sense of what is it that they're going to do with that money and if it's going to be money well spent. We see the department to discuss the annual performance plan and the strategic plan, I think next week, Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. And just to preempt what might come out, we do have a slot somewhere that Cindy will tell me where we have to interrogate, and I know that Nicro and Mr. Muntingham have been asking the question. The relevance, the doability, I don't know if it's the correct English word, of the white paper. Because presumably their strat plan and their annual performance plan talks to the white paper. So if the white paper in the first instance is no longer relevant, should we be even talking to everything else? Because that's where it begins, the white paper and the acts and policies that they have in place, are they doable? So we are going to have that exercise, so please don't talk to us about that. We will make time to do it, but regardless of all that, we now have a situation where the department is on 18 billion, 19 billion there, on the basis of whatever we have. The question that we need to answer is that money going to be well spent in terms of the annual performance plan that they're giving to us as committee next week? That's really what we wanted you to talk about. I do know that there are sector-specific POPGRU and SA. You might not be looking at the whole. You might be looking at those that are specific to yours. It's fine. But really, we wanted to look at the whole budget, but we would take all inputs. I know that Public Service Association, you're going to kick off some warning. You have welcome, and you will be followed by POPGRU, who we know are here, we've seen, and then Mr. Munching, you and your team will then follow up to POPGRU. So you all have the agenda before you. And then we have just detention, and then we would have Nico, and you should be out of there by lunchtime. We did receive written submission from ISS, from the Justice Project and the Gender Health Justice Research Unit, so those written submissions will also be issues that we've got to the attention of members and will be also used, so not only the written for the oral submission, but the written submission will also be used. Association for Prevention of Torture also given us something, the Center for Legal Aid has given us something, and the Young in Prison have also given us something. So all those would be integrated in our preparation. Since have said that they are unable to because of resource limitations, so members won't get anything for six. So those are the various short documents other than the strat plan, the annual performance plan, and the budget that would be our short document. And we've also this year tried to focus it a bit so that we can ask specific questions and not random questions. Members have received them talking about humane detention and so on and relating it to the budget. I think at the end of the day we want to be able to have a meaningful debate here. Just to give members an example, the minister has gone public pronouncing that everybody that is incarcerated with less than grade 9, I think, will be forced to go to school. The question is, do we have that in his ADD? Because following the permission, that everybody that doesn't have a grade 9 is going to go to school? Or do we have systems that will make sure that we are able to identify that these individuals don't have grade 9? Or is this just some rhetoric that the minister has put out there because he got 9 here? That's the real kind of debate that we're going to have this year. So we're hoping that when you and COPCRU and PSA and ICRO talk to us, that you assist us in having a real debate and not just looking in your own or lobbying for your own piece of the cake, which is fine, but we think the time has come that we really are convinced that the department can't come here and say, Mr. Self, that we're going to create 120,000 jobs. The question is 120,000 jobs, or did one person win the 120,000? And then you say you create 120 jobs. So we want you as you give us your input, because we assume that you guys are on the ground, that you are able to say to us, when you do whatever you do, don't forget to ask that type of a question, whether it's a labor-related issue or micro, a rehabilitation issue, or Mr. Munting, a torture issue, that type of thing. Once again, welcome everybody. Everybody's got about 20 minutes if I look at Cindy's program, and then 10 minutes for members to ask questions of clarity. That seems to be the time frame that we have. It is 9:45. Everybody's happy with the approach. We will then hand over to the Public Service Association, and we will stop you, sir, around about 10 past. And then we will allow members to ask questions of clarity. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson, members of Parliament, colleagues from Labour, and other stakeholders. It's a privilege once again for us to be invited to this meeting. As an introduction, Chairperson, the Public Service Association of South Africa is a registered trade union in terms of the Labour Relations Act, Act 66 of 1995, as amended. The PLA, members have got the submission?
Okay.
The PSA is actively organising all spheres of government and is currently the biggest political non-aligned union in the Republic of South Africa. It is our core business to protect rights and interests of our members in their employment relationship with the state. The PSA obtained the majority status in the GPAACC, 51% in 2011, and is therefore a key stakeholder in the negotiation process as far as it relates to the departmental chambers affiliated to the GPAACC. Overcrowding and staffing levels. It is right that the majority of South African prisons were built by the previous apartheid government, and it was meant for purposes other than rehabilitation. It is further regarded as right that the majority of prisons were built with huge community cells, with few single cells. Single cells were mainly used as punishment for inmates who transgressed the rules of prison. The prisons with large community cells were originally built to accommodate on average between 21 to 32 offenders, depending on the size of the facility. Over the recent years, it became the norm to fit the average holding capacity plus at least 50% more prisoners in for accommodation purposes. This means that in some instances, cells that were built for 32 people are used to accommodate more than 50 inmates. The reality of overcrowding is more gang-related activities. The difficulty for prison management is to separate gangsters from non-gangsters in community cells. There is just not enough space or holding capacity for the quantum of inmates. Furthermore, it needs to be emphasized that the staff establishment of correctional services does not make provision for the overcrowding. The staff establishment of prisons is also hopelessly understaffed due to the overcrowding statistics at some institutions. It was a great shock that the PLA took note of the cut of plasma and 5,000
3,000 staff members to ensure successful implementation of the seven-day establishment. It is even a greater shock when perusing through the strategic and performance plans of the Department of Operational Services for 2013-2014 financial year, that the executive authority plans to increase the staff establishment to plus minus 1,500 employees. This increase was motivated for regional and head office in order to make provision for municipal accounting administration purposes. It is as if this department doesn't realize the reality of short staffing. Since January 2013, numerous employees were severely injured due to gangsters that attacked correctional officials. Employees at St. Albans Prison requested management to address them with regard to their safety, but instead 122 members were suspended last month and are currently facing disciplinary hearings. The PSA wrote a letter to the National Commissioner in November 2012 with regard to overcrowding and shortage of staff that are posing a direct threat to the safety of correctional officials in the workplace. This was highlighted at the ministerial forum held during February this year. To date, the Commissioner didn't reply to the letter that was formulated on advice of our attorneys. And so, listen, I want to add here also at this ministerial forum, which were held in February, the minister announced that this is the year for the correctional official. He made it public that correctional officials will not stand second in line this year. However, if one looks at the establishment of correctional services, our member safety is really at risk at this point in time because of understaffing. I just wanted to highlight that. The PSA welcomed the rollout of the electronic monitoring system, and it is our view that the department should expedite the system to its full capacity. The PSA further suggests that this system of electronic monitoring could be used to ensure effective monitoring that may lead to more releases of detainees on parole and correctional supervision. Correctional services might propose reduction of qualifying criteria and periods for parole and correctional supervision to Parliament in order to maximize the effective use of the electronic monitoring system. The PSA is also of the view that the unsentenced detainees are the main contributor to the high level of overcrowding. Detainees that do not qualify for bail due to various factors are the responsibility of the South African Police Service, but due to insufficient infrastructure, the South African Police and the then prison services made the arrangement that correctional services should take care of the detainees and provide accommodation for them. The South African Police Service is responsible to take these detainees to courts, hospitals, whereas the Department of Correctional Services is responsible to provide accommodation, nutrition, in-house medical care, and access rights to the unsentenced awaiting trial detainees. Due to the current situation within the South African prisons, with specific reference to overcrowding and shortening of staff, it is time for the South African Police Service to take full responsibility for unsentenced detainees. This doesn't mean that SAP can build new detention facilities, but SAP should take responsibility for the staffing of the unsentenced prison units. The PSA wants to reiterate its disappointment with the department for not planning to appoint a much-needed staff to implement the seven-day shift system, which will ensure more hands dealing with the overcrowded prisons. Conditions of incarceration of women. Prisons across the country were built for penal purposes and as holding facilities for prisoners. PSA is against all forms of luxurious accommodation for all prisoners, irrelevant of gender. It, however, remains the fact that the current conditions don't provide for a suitable environment for rehabilitation. Buildings are old and cold, or are buildings that in many instances were built by the apartheid government. Women and prisoners need to develop skills that will ensure successful reintegration to society upon their release. Aggressive educational programs need to be marketed promptly amongst female detainees. Most female prisoners have children, and therefore, their children need them at home, not in prisons. The PSA is of the view that the department should undertake a study on what constitutes an international-based practice in this regard in order to benchmark its current practices. The rehabilitation
The white paper on corrections paved the way to a more balanced approach on safe custody and rehabilitation rather than a punitive lock of prison. Since the introduction of the white paper on corrections, re-offender totals didn't show much decrease. Case officers' job descriptions are to take control over the unit management of a small group of offenders that basically walk step by step with them through the recommended programs and report progress on the individual case file. The current situation inside prisons is that case officers are mainly used as security officers because of the staff shortage, and this will remain until the staff shortage is addressed. The 7-day establishment that was implemented during 2009 with the signing of GPWPC 2 of 2009 is not getting off the ground. The 7-day establishment was the foundation on which the rehabilitation of offenders would benefit from due to 12-hour shifts that would have allowed more time for rehabilitation programs. It was also aimed at stretching the 5-day working week to a 7-day working week, where if offenders could participate in rehabilitation programs over a longer period of time. The unit management system was implemented in 2003 after the 2002 restructuring program of the public service. This system allowed for unit managers to manage smaller groups of detainees and attend to specific needs and complaints of inmates more promptly and directly. It was designed to assist these centers to manage the huge population of prisoners in correctional centers, and also to assist in identifying the necessary programs needed to address offender behavior, and also to allow for workable groups of offenders in monitoring rehabilitation of the offenders. The truth of what is currently happening at the majority of centers is that the head of centers are struggling to use the benefit of the unit management system together with the 7-day establishment because of low levels of staff. It is expected of centers to be fully functional for 7 days, where in the past it was for 5 days. It is furthermore expected of centers to allow for shifts that will ensure longer hours of operations in any day or rehabilitation program, and to adhere to the 14-hour meal system as prescribed by the Correctional Services Act. All this should be managed with average 10% less staff when centers were fully operational for 5 days in a week, with day shifts of 8 hours long. Tremendously high overcrowding levels, low staff morale because of outstanding matters, limited case officers, labor intense security programs because of assaults on employees. The PSA is of the view that rehabilitation programs will struggle to reach the desired impact during the coming financial year because of the shortage of staff to present the programs to the offenders. Assault. The Minister of Correctional Services highlighted the numerous assaults that recently occur where prison gang members attack correctional officials at the Ministerial Consultative Forum. At the same Ministerial Consultative Forum, the PSA referred to not less than 6 correctional officers that were assaulted in separate incidents at the St. Albans Prison in Port Elizabeth. Members were severely injured in these gang-related attacks during January and February this year. Tipperton also this morning we learned of an escape at Wolfsburg Prison, and also that one of the members of the employees were stabbed in that incident at Wolfsburg. One of the main aims of gangs is to ensure privileges for detainees. With the current situation whereby inmates receive limited exercise because of insufficient staff to run operations, gangs will get more frustrated. According to gang law, the only way to deal with matters that frustrate them is to use violence. St. Albans is an example, and we may experience an increase in prison violence if the authorities aren't going to implement programs that will lead to the appointment of 23,000 new correctional officials. Chairperson, really, this whole paper speaks to overcrowding, the current situation with inside our prisons, and really that there is a shortage of staff. It is right that there is a real shortage of plus minus 23,000 employees in this department. and our members, its employees, that on daily basis are confronted with situations with gangs, with assault, with aggression, and our staff, and we need staff. Our plea in this round of talk are really, Chairperson, that the portfolio committee look into this matter of understaffing and request the department to ensure sufficient staff going forward. Otherwise, rehabilitation, there is no case officer that can attend to the program, because the main situation currently inside our presence is that those who are dedicated to entertain program are used as security officers. Because people need to go to court. You have to have three or four people in a section looking after prisoners, and if they are none, they use those officers to do that. So rehabilitation will take a back seat at this one. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, sir. Just before we start your representation of the 41,000 people that are this year, how many do you represent?
In correctional services, correctional services are about 14,000.
14,000 of the 41,000.
Yes.
And rural you have the rest, some more or less.
Thank you, Honourable Chapter. Honourable Member of the Portfolio Committee, Leadership of Correctional Services, fellow members from the Labour, the General. It's always an honour to welcome to take part in this colloquium in order to share the input and exchange ideas, this time on the 2013-14 Budget Plan. We've been looking forward to this kind of engagement and confidence that we will support a new direction to the improvement of the Department of Corrections. Allow me to outline today's focus areas as advised by Parliament, starting with the conditions of incarceration for women. Women inmates comprise just approximately 3% of the inmate population. It is significant that over the past few years, there was a slight increase in the female inmate population, reaching 3,758 in 2011-2012. We acknowledge the progress made by the department in ensuring that women are incarcerated under best conditions, but our opinion that the department can still needs to do more in creating such conducive conditions for the rehabilitation of women offenders. Man and baby units and facilities designed for women inmates and offender labor skills development for women offenders should be continued with improvement. The 2013-14 strategic plan indicates that the department will adhere to the protection of human rights of inmates, particularly of special categories of inmates such as women and children. We welcome such initiatives, but it could have been more important if the department applied in detail as to how they intend to achieve this goal, as we are well aware that in some facilities, conditions of women are quite undesirable. Rehabilitation. South Africa has one of the highest incarceration rates in the world, and this does not seem to have an impact on the public sphere to commit crime. And as a result, the country's overcrowded correctional facilities have become public health hazards where inmates are infected with various such as TB and HIV/AIDS, almost daily. In return, correctional officials' working conditions become rather due to unfavorable working conditions within this facility. Having said with the fact that the 2013-14 budget still does not take the application, and a serious challenge that requires more funding in order to address the current status which is unacceptable. Rehabilitation is the core function of the department as inability to rehabilitate offenders puts more that is the citizenry of the country. We therefore request the department to allocate reasonable funds which will ensure that this program becomes a success to South Africa, so that South Africa becomes a safer country for all who live. Even in the efforts of reputation and human dignity embraced by some political leaders and interest in the legislation and policy, conditions of correctional facilities in our country continue to deteriorate, overcrowding and the resulting problems of frustrate any attempt at adaptation. The Department of Correctional Services continues to face challenges, all of which are compounded by the lack of resources available to keep up with the increasing demand for space in the service. Most existing communal cells are still conducive to human, are still not conducive to human dignity, even when utilized at their intended capacity. Entirely improved facilities are needed, both to relocate the old ones, as well as to provide additional capacity, but this requires substantial capital investment, which the budget should give more priority to. Surely not the GDP. You should bear in mind that correctional services is the last hope for victims of crime, and for many of the individuals sentenced for crime. All offenders except for life who are considered unsuitable for parole return to society at the end of their sentence. It's our responsibility to ensure that they are in the best state to be constructive members of society upon their release. Key to rehabilitation is empowering offenders to have skills to function effectively in society once released. Particularly important is to ensure that offenders are actively involved in productive activities whilst they serve their sentence. We used to witness in correctional services the effective production of vegetables, pork, beef, chicken, furniture and others. The production of such commodities was saved internally and there was savings in the public fund because this department was self-sufficient. Construction of correctional centers was put up by the inmates. All the office furniture within the department was initially erected internally by the union. The supply of such furniture was for the entire department throughout the country with the reduction of expenditure. Catering was done internally by the inmates themselves. And in the process, the inmates were trained in farming, construction, carpentry, hospitality, and other fields of manufacturing and production. Clearly, the adaptation of inmates was effective with such activities and not what we dream about today. Instead of continuing with such best practices, the DCS today is spending millions just for the construction of correctional centers by private companies. There are 248 public institutions around the country which were constructed by the inmates. The two private prisons, which we argue that they could consume half of the DCS budget, and the 248 institutions have to share the other half. Millions of rents are spent on food for inmates, which was initially manufactured in the department. And millions of the taxpayers' money were spent on private companies to enter the correctional centers for catering, which is still done by the inmates and members still doing the safeguard service. The question that comes is really necessary to opt for expensive methods of delivering public services, and each of which the answer is a great no. The approach was merely pushed by a gluttony to get the tender made possible. Those who are in charge of the private institution today were in the DCS yesterday and made sure that they only created their way out. Majority of these issues were investigated and it was established that there were some rough practices in handling of such tenants. The white paper on correction focused on the transformation of the Department of Correctional Services into an institution of rehabilitation. It's therefore vital for the budget to be in favor of supporting public safety while at the same time enhancing effective rehabilitation of offenders. The DCS must regard the effective social reintegration of offenders as the most challenging and crucial aspect of rehabilitation. On actual torture and inhumane treatment, The judicial inspectorate has continued to raise concern about human conditions in treatment and many instances of abuse of inmates amounting to ill treatment or torture. So it's not clear as to how many correctional officers are criminally charged with discipline for such activities. We acknowledge that it's sometimes necessary for correctional officials to use force as a correctional service and its management establish the principles underlying the use of force and the parameters within which force can be used. But emanating from various reported incidents of assault, it's clear that the issue of less lethal and the same equipment and its use should be reduced if the department is effectively preventing the torture of inmates, but the safety of correctional officials should be prioritized in this process, as it is known that the prison population can be extremely dangerous to remember. The environment within the facilities is quite hostile. It's left our submission that the department fill all vacant positions, more especially the specialized, not skilled, not skilled positions such as social workers, psychologists, and so on, as well as training and developing members on various applicable legislation that govern their day-to-day operations. This will harmonize the environment and ensure that rehabilitation takes place as expected. On overcrowding, with approximately 560,545 inmates, South Africa had one of the highest incarceration in the continent. The well-known fact that the growth of South Africa's correctional population has outpaced capacity, resulting in overcrowding being the primary issue affecting the conditions of correctional facilities today. These overcrowded conditions will place any facilities system under strain and is likely to elicit a more sympathetic response from human rights organizations. We are disturbed with the fact that the immediate effects of overcrowding are decreased security. This is mainly caused by the phenomenon that where the same number of correctional officers is responsible for an increasing number of inmates and as a result posing security threats on the safety of officials. Popular admits the fact that incarceration should be allocated vulnerable funds, this will impact positively towards the well-being of the correctional officers, as decreased security, cramped conditions, and lack of personal space leads to increased violent assaults against officials or within the correctional facility. While we have the view that the facility should remain secure at all times, the challenge of spending on security remains extremely high, but the projected outcomes are always tremendously low. It's helpless that a bigger chunk of budget spends on projects that are high in cost and have limited outcomes. Since 2005, billions of funds have been spent on security with little effect. A lot of investment in social security should have had a much higher impact on the budget, and therefore get the department to relocate this effect when allocating the funds. Our general overview was to conclude to honor the chairperson. We acknowledge the fact that we had specific focus areas that we outlined, but we feel that we will be representing our movement if we don't raise the mammoth challenge of outsourcing within the department of correctional safety. On the 10th of October 2011, not 2001, the Auditor General's office stated that the IT systems in correctional services were run by consultants. The DCS had to secure IT systems and intellectual property and licensing linked to it. The login system was not being operated efficiently, and there has been duplication of worksheet schedules. This year, 2013, the Auditor General's latest report found that a total of 102 billion was spent on consultants, and more than a billion of this amount went to IT projects that were overpaid or remunerated for the jobs not completed or not done at all. It's clear from this lecture fact that one component of government, which is correctional services, is run and operated by consultants, and it can't keep quiet when the public debt recklessly utilized in this fashion. No matter who gets hurt, it's wrong, immoral, and it has to discontinue. We thought we should raise this point of continuously, And we'll be following up even outside this four walls to ensure that what the department complains, what government complains about, which is also the great concern to us, is rectified and taken care of. It's rather disappointing to realize that the department continues to face serious organizational and policy challenges that inhibit its ability to implement both the White Paper and Correctional Services Act. We are really concerned about the continued lack of synergy between the objectives obtained in the White Paper on Correction and the Department of Budget Allocation Cost Program. While the DCS tends to put reputation at the center of its activities, the budget remains skewed towards integration and administration. While very little is spent on reputation, care and social integration of offenders, these three programs are key towards addressing offending behavior and facilitating reintegration. As a result, reducing the risk of re-offending. A focused and deliberate transformation of correctional systems, both in its systematic and organizational foundation, should ensure that emphasis placed on rehabilitation and successful reintegration of offenders, as opposed to merely providing security integration during the period of incarceration. Chairperson, it needs to be noted that the successes of the programs being implemented entirely in the department also depends on the skills and competencies of the employees. It's therefore crucial that the department begins to take the issue of staff development seriously and put appropriate mechanisms in place. The same conclusion, correctional centers must be places for not locking up people, throwing away key, not for letting offenders rot in themselves, but places where offenders have to face up to what they have done victims, have to engage with the social justice process, have to complete correction and development programs. Where offenders are involved in production workshops, they carry farming and return to the community with the required skills. It's key that we build the department appropriately geared for delivery on the White Paper on correction and White Paper on remand detention with good governance, high level of compliance and tight system of management, appropriate resourcing and tight resource management and accountability. Meeting the minimum requirements for human detention in facilities should be an absolute priority for the Department of Correctional Services. To achieve this, it's essential that officials are adequately trained to manage inmates in a manner that is in line with the requirements of the Correctional Services Act. We try that the points raised here will contribute towards assisting the department better perform this responsibility. Nyabonga, Mr. Fami.
Sir, I'm going to ask you next. Let's open up Mr. Sal will be the first one. Mr. Rainier, you'll be number two, and Mr. Max will be number three.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the two inputs. I think we would probably agree with quite a lot of what was said. And obviously, we are in agreement, I think, with quite a lot of what was said about the alignment of the budget with the objectives specified in the White Paper and the need to align the staff resources behind those components so that people can do the job. We're also, I think, very sympathetic to the situation in which directional officers, particularly at a lower level to the coal face, find themselves. But if I start with the PSA presentation, I mean, looking through it on a number of occasions, the words are used hopelessly understaffed, short-staffing, low levels of staff shortages, etc. Now, the department will this year have 42,006 employees, looking after 160,000 inmates on average. It will take a couple. That's already a ratio of 1 to 4. Now, the PSA is arguing for an additional 23,000 new officials. It would take us up to 65,000 officials, and the ratio would go down to more than 1 to 3. That could also push up the personnel budget, as I read it, from 12.4 billion to around about 18 billion. So in other words, the entire current budget for corrections would be sent entirely on top. Now, I want PSA please to comment on the real issue which I think is a problem, and that is that the staff aren't employed in the right place. In other words, there are too many people hanging around doing pushing papers around desks, not enough people doing the hard job of, as was said, escorting prisoners, unit management, security operations, and so on. I'm not sure that 65,000 employees at a cost of about 18 billion rand is sustainable. Moving on to Tom Crew's presentation, I'm very intrigued by the statement there on page 4, towards the bottom, that we're stated that the two private prisons consume half the budget of the DCS. 248 institutions have to share only half that budget. Now, the budget this year is 18.7 billion rand. According to the Department of Budgeting, approximately a billion rand a year are spent on the PDPs. I want to know whether that, how Prof. Crew justifies that statement. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you,
Chair.
And thank you for the board's presentation. Chair, I'll start with the PSA. Just as an insight, the way it was presented, to me, I don't have a question, but Inspector, I can recommend that most of what they are saying is what Jefferson were crying about. But I was expecting more in terms of how to solve this problem. Because, yes, it's true, when we come to oversight, we have observed that there are gangs in our center, which is the challenge that needs all of us to come with a solution. And most of the questions that is in the document check is the question that we need to the department. In terms of the pop crochet, I was existing similar to me, although at the beginning in the Lebanon. At least top spending. On call crew checking, I was expecting the call crew to talk more about the behavior of their members in our session. Not to look only one side in terms of the inmate that are approaching the staff, but the staff itself also. There are those, there are some of them, they are the one that they assault the inmate. So that's why I said, check, this needs to be the same. And as a corporal that stands for the members, I was expecting the corporal also to come up with a solution of 7 days establishment. Because I believe that they were part of it. And if it is not implemented effectively in our center, how is the pop group, what is the pop group doing to make this 7 day establishment work? In terms of the shortage of that, we understand that, there is a shortage of staff. Because we don't have professionals in our center. It's a problem of the department to make sure that we get those professionals in our center. In terms of the salary of the members of the staff, I was expecting the program to talk more about it, because this is what they cry about. vocabulary that they are not getting enough money. And sometimes I just assume that maybe that's why they smuggle inside in our center. And yet, but it's not a thing that we can just say it's right to smuggle, because they did a song to say, I'm taking this job with my honesty, that I'm going to do this job honestly. But now, what we found when we go through the oversight, we find that sometimes they are making friends with this inmate by smuggling with them. So I was expecting more on focal check to talk about their staff and the people that are there for them. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. To both the A and Pop Group, with regard to gangsterism, indicated by PSA, I think on page 2 of the presentation, about the gang separation of gangsters from non-gangsters. I would like to know from both the unions, accordingly, what is the magnitude of this problem? And what is your proposal? How should this be addressed by DCA? And DCA presented to us in their annual plan, as well as the strategic plan, that they do have a policy with regard to a gangsterism policy, a plan. Did you people, with your interaction with the department, peruse this? Are you aware of the plan? And do you agree with that particular plan? Do you think it is sufficient for it to be implemented to address the problem? With regard to rehabilitation, Chairperson, it is a hard word in terms of the white paper, as well as reintegration. So, this I heard that they joined this committee in 2010. Now, is there any hard figures or percentage for the past length of year and previous years on how many of the 160 towns were successfully rehabilitated and reintegrated? To see whether the money spent is worth the cause, and if not, more attention should be given. Then, on the other hand, I align myself with the views and the input of the Honourable Member himself with regard to the ratio and between employees and inmates. Now, if it is, for argument's sake, so that these 40,000 plus members are properly employed at grassroots level, the common place, and some of them sit in the air conditioning offices, pen pushers and paper people, that in any working agreement, there's obligations by both employer as well as the employee. For instance, the employee should report on duty and agree to execute the services by the employer as indicated, and should be loyal, intelligent, and should not transgress. On the other hand, the employer should accept the employee in service, pay him or her the remuneration agreed, and most importantly, ensure a safe environment to work in. Now, are you who represent these members who tell us every year that this is a danger and the employee is not complying with that particular provision? Now, obviously that is a breach of the employment contract. However, you have to bear in mind that the environment in which the people are working is risky by itself. Now, if the utilization, the 7 days shift system, is not contributing to that safety of the members, deploy their members properly, it should not, or the risk would have been minimized. So, I just want to know what you do about that one. And my last one is to Poku. On page 4, you mentioned that by utilizing inmates to mold places, furniture, whatever, there was a huge amount of public funds saved. Do you have an amount for that savings? And if that savings is significant, then obviously we are starting with the department to employ artisans and to pay them well. So if you mention it, do you have an amount for things that you get this?
The POSCO is a design developmental problem whereby in the past the inmates used to produce pork, beef, chicken, and venison in federal communities like production of workshops by bakers and farming had to be done. What I want to know is that currently there is no killing pattern to the inmates, according to nothing is done. So just I'm curious. Then number two, you are also interesting that this has been to do more better or improve the lives of women in incarceration. On what do you recommend to be done? What more do you want to be being done with women in incarceration? Thank you.
Okay, all right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Let me pose my question. First of all, I want to agree with Mr. Self on the ratio, 3.9 if you take the 41 and it goes to about 2.5 if you take your 64, if you include your 23. I'm just raising that and asking, I think the question that he's raised are number one. But in your input, you paint a gloomy picture on everything that you asked, whether it was rehab, all those things. You paint a gloomy picture because of staff shortages, I think is the underlying theme, and that's why you're asking for 23,000 more. The question that I'm raising, sir, is and I'm putting it deliberately to you people, both you and Popcorn, because you are labor organizations. You see, you can't argue that the 41,000 is not nearly enough to look after the employees, I mean after the inmates, because you do all these different things. You must take them to hospital, you must all those things. So in other words, in the cell itself, the ratio of 1 to 300 and so on, this is a problem. And on the other hand, you argue that you do not have enough rehabilitation. I mean, have you guys ever thought about saying, let us 24,000 or 21,000 or 41,000 concentrate on the thing you're talking about, the core business, which is, or let's say the core business, it's a bit different. The 41,000 looks after the security, and we outsource the rehab and those things to the Nickels and to everybody else. Have you guys ever thought about that? I'm just asking the question. Have you done that cost benefit analysis? Will your 23,000 people address rehab, gang, all those things? Because for you, the panacea seems to be give us 23,000 people and we fix up rehab, we fix up overcrowding. I'm asking the question, if we left you as you were and gave the experts in the field to do the other stuff, would that not be a more cost effective? And I'm asking you specifically because I know the unions would want to have it enforced. But let's look at it really from a cost benefit. So that's the first question. And then, PSA, you know, you and correctly so said that this was the year, I'm going on what Mam Gwenya said, I'm really emphasizing that this is the year of the official, and we agree. And yet, last night, 5 officials escaped from LNM. 5 inmates, I beg your pardon. I wish the officials had escaped. 5 inmates escaped from LNM. With an unlicensed firearm and 11 rounds, or 11 bullets. Now, can only be officials that have smuggled things in. They can't pour from the... It can only be officials that have smuggled things in. Or officials negative that there is an unlicensed buyer coming out of the city. I can tell you that at Jobo Central, which is my constituency, now, I'll give you the phone numbers of at least 6 inmates that live in my constituency. 6 inmates that live in my constituency have cell phones. You know them. But if you go to Sun City now, you know half of them have got cell phones. Half of them. The inmates go to Texas. You know about the living residents, and I'm a gang leader. I phone you as an inmate and I say, go to Texas. I want to put money market into your account now at Supply Town Texas. Go with your bank account, you pick it up at Southgate Texas. 10 rand is going to you, and that is 10 rand gives you my brother that's in San Francisco or Jovan Central. By official. These are not secrets. Now, you can't come here and argue that this is the year of the official, and the official is not going to be taken in queue. But none of you come here and say to us, get some on officials. None of you have said that. Unless you say none of your officials are corrupt, or you're going to be saying to us, innocent until proven guilty, you're going to be saying to us, all these things, somebody's got rank on duty, he gets a final written warning. Somebody's got DACA. These things are happening all the day, and these are your officials. You don't come and talk those things. You ask us to give you 23,000 more officials. I think the question that Mongrel and others are asking is, even if we gave you 5,000 or 15,000 more officials, if they're going to smuggle guns in, or if they're going to be on the payroll of drug lord from Westbury, it's not going to help the situation. What are you guys saying about the officials? I think that's the question that we must ask. Because, Nancy, I really think the time has come where leadership of POKRU needs to say, if there's an official, he must get out of it. But you guys defend them in many, many instances, and we'll give that to you if you really need them. We know these people by name, we know their cell phone numbers as well. So you guys are not really talking to them, and I'm saying that issue I want to support on members of saying, but it can't be, I think the point that we're making is that it can't be the year official and the official doesn't improve his or her behavior. And POKRU doesn't come and say anything to us about it. And just to reiterate what other members have said, gang management, the deployment, that's not the issue rather than getting 23,000 more. Your calculations of your PPPs. I think Mambuena and I spoke about the staff behavior. Then somebody asked a question about your success rates, rehabilitation one. Somebody else asked about, are you saying that there are no skillings taking place at all POKRU, as the paper seems to suggest? And what are your suggestions on the improvement of women that are incarcerated? If you can respond to those questions, if members want the second round, we'll have a second bite and then we'll move to others. In any order, maybe we should start with you, POKRU. Those that you think you want to answer, we'll pick them off. And then PSA, those that you want to answer, we'll pick them off and then you see if there's any gaps.
Thank you, Chapa. I'll touch on some areas in it. The question of staff. Well, to a lesser extent, we do agree with all our members that the figures that are there in the department are to a certain extent adequate. It's how they are utilized. And I think we have made this point many times in this forum about the church that is built there in correctional services. A top head structure. Duplication of functions in head office. Mr. Merkel calls it the sitting in air conditioned office. You know, so it's skewed utilization, and we called for the restructuring of the departments in many Yeah, we were talking about that, that we have 42,000, but the majority of members, they are in head offices, in provincial offices. And the whole space on the ground where you need more members is less. I think in 2000, the year 2000, the head office of the department was almost, was less than 800 in terms of staff. Today, it is almost, the establishment there is almost bigger than some of the management areas. And then you ask yourself, what is happening, or what are the functions of this, because this should be a lean and mean body that should be utilized for policy formulation, and we don't need that big head to construct policy. Now, here we do agree to a certain extent that the utilization thereof is a mess, or the staffing, the placement thereof. So the complete restructuring of the department to focus on the cold phase will be a priority in that regard. On the budget itself, I think I've used it, not just in the
I'm sorry, you're going. Maybe Mr. Lancaster indicates you're going to help us. You know, restructuring is a very deep word. You know, it could mean relooking at it. Are you talking about restructuring, or are you talking about redeploying people from HQ to the fact? You know, restructuring is something else. Restructuring talks about business architecture and all that. I think what members are saying is, if you took 50 people that are sitting in Victoria or in regional office and put them into the prison center, put it that way, some of these problems will be resolved. So what I'm trying to get from you is that what you are saying, or are you saying we must relook at the way correctional services does business? What does this actually mean in your...
Okay. The restructuring chair refers to indeed the complete overhaul of the... look, in head office, with the ballooning of the structure in head office, there has been creation of some functions. In the process, duplicating others which are already there, you can club together some of the functions to be aligned to, well, say, controlled by one office, well, with a number of smaller. Then some of those functions, say, I mean, the human capital now, the people, also to be, but you, because of the nature of the establishment now, you, if you remove people from one opponent to the other, it will be their base positions, even there where you move. So it's the complete overall of the structure. On the issue of the half of the budget, indeed, I do agree. Yes, I will use the word almost half of the budget, which is utilized by the PPP, the two PPP. I mean, even the figure that is there now utilized by this is too much. It's too much for to be utilized by only two institutions, which do not take one inmate extra as a book for overcoming. Then you've got all this squeezed to the fullest, just like the public institutions. So even too much, that figure that is allocated for the institution. The Honorable Mongwenya, behavior of members assaulting inmates. Now, we touched on that one, and we don't condone that kind of behavior. We look from all angles, obviously. And now, this is coupled with what you asked about. We're not saying we should go getting anything. We should get tough on the members and so on. No, I think our part is placed. We have signed, we have entered into collective agreements on how to deal with either corrupt or ill-disciplined members. The assets is in place. The house part is the department must utilize the systems that are there to make sure that you sip apples, rotten apples out of the filter. So, of course, if the members have their charge. touch for anything, it is our role to represent them, to ensure that the systems that we in place to deal with misconduct or ill behavior, they are followed to the latter. If a member is dismissed, but it is good process, by all means, it's just that they are processed. Obviously, in the presumption of innocence until proven guilty should play, because some, of course, they are just allegations by attitude or hatred, but they are tangible evidence. So, but there are things to deal with such behavior. And we do not condone any misbehavior by our members. And we preach, in our structures, we preach that we should be concentrating on service delivery and other positive engagements. So, any form, the department is saying, they would have nobody to say itself if there are such wrong things. And we are not responsible anyway for charge number.
We are asking the question fine. I was asking if they've got an annual report. Somebody is drunk on duty. Somebody has smuggled in or was under the influence of habit forming, I think is what you use in your book, habit forming drugs or whatever. And he or she gets a final written note. What is your view on it? I know you're saying that it's not my duty to be the judge because I'm there, but I'm asking you, as you said, CSA, that you make a stakeholder in this thing. That was your presentation. Now I'm asking you as a major stakeholder, if somebody is drunk on duty in a security system, somebody smuggles in and or uses habit-forming drugs, as it is, goes through any year annual report, somebody there has stolen money or whatever. Any year annual report. Our frustration is the tension then become a written notice, a written warning or not. I'm asking you as representatives of labor, what is your view on that? Don't say to me, you're not the one to be. I know you are not the one to be, but what is your view on it? Because you see, outside there, somebody gets a sentence of suspended sentence for murder. You don't say no to the judge. We as civil society make a noise on. Why should so and so only get 2 years sentence? Nobody says no, but there's judges for it. Now we know that in this instance the judges might be the officials of DCS, but I'm asking you as organized labor, what are you saying about the life sanctions? Because you're saying to us, I would make sure that procedures followed through the letter. If somebody is dismissed, so be it. But if it is so blatantly wrong, the judgment is so blatantly wrong, do you guys then tell them, what are you just asking the question? Because if you want me to give it to you, I'm sure I haven't opened it. I'm sure if I open it up here, there will be offenses that even you will be embarrassed about, in terms of the offense and the sanction. What are you guys saying about this?
Chairperson, I think our answer is simple. We condemn any form of ill discipline, and we are preaching that to our members. And I will emphasize that one, that indeed it is our role to ensure that whatever misconduct or allegation of misconduct against any member is taken through a process. Look, there are, obviously there will be a lot of members who are in correctional services who are not supposed to be there. And some we have represented. And why? Because the department did not follow the procedure. A typical example, there was this noise about the escape in Hedgeston 2-3 years ago. Now, out of agitation, anger, and that we must condemn this thing. Remember, someone did this. But what it is, Sal, Hamba, go away. Those members are affected where? Stay. Merely because it was here, negligent in the process. But because the process was not followed, what options do we have? Out of the department now. When you go, you've got the arbitrator there who must look at the facts. You've got the judge who must look at the not condone any form of ill discipline or misbehavior, and obviously the sanction must fit the conduct. That should be our response on the matter. Gangsterism, surely that one is not necessary in the area of correctional services alone, because it does not start in prison. It is linked to the society. We know what is happening, but in this process, in gangsterism, what is that they are almost operating from outside, operating in the institutions. It's a well entrenched societal problem, which a department on its own cannot defeat. It needs the broader population and everybody, all the stakeholders, to tackle it. No killing of inmates and we are making proposals on practical things that are practical, they are working. What we have stipulated here is what was happening in correctional services just a few years ago, until they were stopped, because now we must fit, or there should be some form of outsourcing of those functions. Now, the field, the department has got a field, lots of fields. They've got the grown grass as big as this building, because they're not utilized, and the big portion of the population is sitting inside and doing nothing, and feeding now into the gangsterism, because it's IT mine, which is they're doing nothing. The farming in this has almost collapsed. The workshops that are there, which must be utilized for rehabilitation of inmates, almost empty. And this is what I'm talking about. So we're not saying we should bring something new. If the infrastructure is there, it must just be utilized. And keeping members of these inmates busy during the day. But now they are 23 hours in sitting there doing nothing for years. So what's going to happen, obviously, in their idle mind? Let me leave it for the comrades here to proceed. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. If I can start with the ratio, the 41,000 employees currently and the plan to appoint 23,000 employees, that will roughly calculate 64,000 employees versus the 160,000 inmates. Our comment is that really we must go back and see where the thing is coming from. We must remember that in correctional services, there was a five-day establishment from Monday to Friday, 8 hours a day, with 45,500 employees. We have changed that system to allow more time for giving effect to the white paper in terms of rehabilitation. We have changed the system to a seven-day establishment. From 8 hours a day, the example that was put to this committee by the department at that time was to allow for a 12-hour rehabilitation period in a day. Meaning that if you change the system from 5 days, 8 hours, to 7 days full operational, 12 hours, with 5,000 less employees, and this committee is saying, well, the ratio 1-4, I want to indicate to this committee that you need one security officer to escort one prisoner to a court, to a hospital, but that's not all you need.
vehicle to transport that inmate or inmates to various facilities outside. Running a prison is labor intensive. We must realize that. You cannot operate a prison electronically alone. It is a very labor intensive organization, the prison. And then also, the system has changed from a dominant security facility to a balanced approach where you have security and rehabilitation in terms of the white paper surgeries. And 1 to 4 is the academic calculation according to us. That does not reflect the, as a chairperson referred to, the 1 to 300 inside the center, where people are kept and where rehabilitation programs need to be in order of the day. However, yes, there might be that there are too many, or the feeling I get from the portfolio committee, too many people in administrative positions, if I can call it that way, and not directed to the core of our business. Chairperson, I think, did not use that word, but I believe in terms of the white paper, our core business is to ensure a safe South Africa, and secondly also to rehabilitate those who is in our care. So yes, there is so much pressure on administration also, from government in these days to comply with certain administrative measures that the department is actually forced to extend the administrative component, as I perused through the document, I saw that to comply with municipal accounting administration procedures, the department needs more employees. So there's also pressure from government in that sense to comply with certain provisions in terms of administration. That one cannot just merely say redeploy those people to where the people are needed, because if you do that, you might find yourself in a situation where you don't have someone to do the administration. That report will be criticized, I believe, by the school committee if that should happen. So being a labor intensive, changing from a 5-day to a 7-day establishment, we must realize that it is a logic population for me. If you change that system, changing the shift means that you split immediately your employees at the ground level if you work a 12-hour shift, because they need to get off at some time. And when they say, well, obviously, only the other half will stand in. So I believe, or the PSA is of the view, that is a real academic calculation, and we must look at the broader thing, just as put by the Honourable Member himself in this instance. We have also noted the members' comment that we did not bring out how to solve these problems in terms of overcrowding, and the Honourable Member referred that she thought that it would be our duty to do that. And indeed, I think our paper we did comment on the electronic monitoring system, we support that, and we think that would be extended really, because that might assist to the future to reduce overcrowding. If that model is really extended to its full capacity, like in terms of international standards, we can utilize this in South Africa, because we have a control measure, knowing exactly where prisoner A or B is at any specific time, and it's not that labor intensive. So obviously, we are saying that really we look at that electronic monitoring system as a solution to overcrowding. Honorable Member Advocate Max referred to gangsterism. Advocate, the policy in terms of gangsterism, we never heard about it, was never consulted with the PSA. So, as stakeholders in terms of the employees, we were not consulted with regards to gangster policy in terms of the department. Is it a real problem? It is. It's gangsters that's behind the assault. Ordinarily, if one could have statistics on that, non-gang members cannot attack or assault an employee in the department, because then he needs to stand trial before the gang, because the only one who can give an order to assault an employee, the correctional official, is standard. So one can just look at the recent assault and ask yourself, is there a problem? Is there an issue? Because our members are stabbed on a daily basis, and it's not by non-gang members, it's gang members. So if we could make a response to you on that one. What did we do? Advocate Max, you have asked what we have done in terms of the Labor Relations Act when it comes to the safety of our people. We have put this on the bargaining chamber, on the bargaining council of the GBWSBC in terms of last year, in terms of an allowance for our members for being exposed to this situation we are currently in. Nothing has come from that, and then we have changed our angle in terms for safety. We have consulted attorneys, and we have indicated in our presentation that we have sent the Minister of the Commissioner of Correctional Services a letter advised by our attorneys in terms of the safety of our members. We must just recall that this is essential services. Once you're essential services, the application of the Act some instances becomes a bit more difficult than in normal circumstances when you are not essential services, where you can just say, well, we're going to use our power in order to ensure safety. It's a much more, it's a process that needs to take in consideration essential services, and it's a legal process. And as we have indicated, we have or sent a letter to the Commissioner of Correctional Services, and it's disappointing at this point in time for us that he has not answered us on that letter. We have also at the Ministerial Forum requested or mentioned this to the Minister that the Commissioner has not answered us. Apparently it's been delegated downwards, and up to this day we have not received an answer on that. Our attorneys, we are in discussion with them to have now a letter from the attorneys to them in order to ensure safety. And if not, we have indicated in this committee in a previous presentation, will this also end up in court? We do not observe members of the committee. Then the chairperson referred to the outsourcing of the rehabilitation component of the Department of Correctional Services. Now, Honourable Chairperson, provision is currently made for NGOs, non-government organizations, to present programs for rehabilitation. And I know in some instances it worked quite well. However, outsourcing the whole component means that rehabilitation will move away from correctional services, and we will become a security institution. Okay. The capacity, I don't know if the NGOs have the capacity even, if we can look at it, if they have the capacity to deliver that on such a huge scale. Because we're not talking about Mossel Bay prison, for instance, where there are 400 inmates, and 200 must receive programs for in terms of the program for a month or two, certain programs. When we're talking about 160,000 in the country, about in Baltimore, how many inmates are there? Are the NGOs, will they be able, and do they have the capacity to take over that? I think it's a big question, and is there not a risk in doing so if there is no capacity or not sufficient human resource to do the rehabilitation? The cost from a cost perspective, I don't know. Maybe the department must look at the cost benefit in terms of that. But in terms of executing the provision within the white paper, it's currently the baby of the original service. We need to look at that. Our stance on discipline, chairperson, you have indicated, well, union was in opposition when someone is drunk on duty. We agree with Cop Crew that there is policy and procedure in place. We
have agreed, collectively agreed, how to deal with as a union. We have signed an agreement where it says this is how you should deal with a person who allegedly committed misconduct. Chairperson, the process makes provision for circumstances. If a person is drunk on duty, we don't know the circumstances of the individual matter. And he or she, there might be a problem in the Act. The Labor Relations Act is also clear when it comes to provisions in terms of conduct in terms of drunk and alcoholic behavior. But when it comes to smuggling, firearms in prison, if one is found guilty on that, it's our position that there's no real reason for such a person to be an employee of the department. That's why we have agreed to the process. The process, in the process, it states that there's no place for such a person. So it's just applying the policy, which we apply. So our position is actually on paper, where we are saying, once that happened, when you are found guilty of smuggling in, that it's goodbye. That's in terms of the policy. We must just remember also that as it's actually a crime to smuggle in a firearm, for instance, and it's against the law, employees also have a right in terms of the Labor Relations Act. They must be treated fairly, as referred to by my colleague Nadia Kalevi. I believe, Chairperson, that the majority of correctional officials in our union is good correctional officials who serve the cause to keep South Africa pure and also to ensure, or trying at this point in time, to keep all the effective rehabilitation programs. Thank you, Chairperson.
Again, Chairperson, you can have a follow-up. Otherwise, we're going to stick on the thing for you, but there's many things. Let me take credit first. Because you have not spoken, who many you follow, and how many you absolute last, and then we'll move on to the next agenda item. I mean, next presentation.
So, do you mean to follow up my questions on the panel?
Your questions are on women, which are the last. There were two, there's one about healing, and there's one about women. Alright? Sorry.
Well, I'll tell you, mine's on page 3 of the CFA report. I just want to find out about the 122 members being suspended by the department. What are the causes of the suspension? And where are they listed now, the 122? And what is the view of TSA with the suspension, if you don't know what they are being given by the department? Yes.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I think on the overcoming case, we are looking at a website, and the PSA detailing their view is that the uncertainty on the main contribute to the high level of overcrowding. And I want to note that if they look at the size of the fact that in our center, Kuma Police Station, do we have a space to put these people? Because really, the overcrowding is more on uncertain people. Then two, Captain, my question was not answered in terms of looking at the salaries that are getting by the staff of correctional training. Chair, I was asking this question because I want to get a sense from the top group that is it true that they are negotiating in terms of looking at the salary of the staff. Because I don't think that it's good for us always when we go to our center, when we call the staff to talk to them, then nationally about the salary that they are making. They are paying police the only cash in person right now, but themselves they are paying aid with the inmate that sentence 24 years, 25 for life sentence, but that salary they are not paid about it. The powers expecting check the union maybe to say on their answer to say we are on the negotiations and when is that going to be solved. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. The Honourable Member referred to the 122 members that were suspended at Selbert. They were suspended because of conducting an unauthorized meeting. However, we are in position of letters approving a meeting from the Area Commissioner. Actually, that meeting was requested after meetings with the Deputy Regional Commissioner in terms of safety, and then that meeting was approved by the management of St. Albans. But the members requested that management address them in terms of the safety situation, or the unsafe working conditions there in St. Albans. And at the end of the day, when they returned to work from all their workplaces from this meeting where they have requested, they were suspended. The other details, the matter is currently, as we speak today, is a disciplinary process in progress. So we cannot comment much more on the detail of what happens, but as a broad framework, that is what transpired there. But we can inform the committee that the suspensions were lifted last week. In terms of SAPs, unsentenced detainees, SPICE, we have put in our presentation, I believe, Chairperson, where we have indicated that we are saying that government or SAPs more specific should hold now new institutions for the unsentenced detainees. We are just saying as an immediate measure going forward, recognizing the understaffing within the department, is that SAPs should provide staffing for the unsentenced component within correctional services, because it's not the correctional services primarily duty to look after unsentenced prison, but that become because of previous arrangements. And now we're sitting with that, and why we say we must share that part with SAPs. They must assert here because it's their responsibility. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Councillor. The women aspect, we are saying we hear the department and they appreciate the initiative that they took on this aspect. However, we are saying it lacks details. We would have expected that there would have been a detailed approach in terms of how that is going to be done. As we say, in terms of how to achieve that goal. We know obviously the limitations that are there as the result of the dilapidated infrastructure that is there. And also, from our point of view, obviously quite an expanded approach in terms of tackling the problem. Not only the system that is there must be enabling that as well to do what is expected to on the rehabilitation aspect. The ceiling, I think, I started broadly when I was talking about what was there and what the infrastructure which is there, which can be utilized in terms of rehabilitation. The salary aspect, Mangwenya, the out there are arrangements of the system that is there in terms of negotiations. The one that you can, in correctional services, you cannot negotiate salary. Only for the entire public service, which is the PSCBC, where everybody is, your teachers, your officers, and all other departments, where negotiations in terms of transit issues, including salaries, are negotiated. So it's, and currently a 3-year agreement that is entered into only towards the tail end of next year that we can start the negotiation in preparation for the other.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there not understanding everything else that has come out of the input. I think what they are and then you might get a disadvantage if you're not going to be able to respond to other people, but they're going to respond to you. When you speak then to the people, they seem to be suggesting that one of the ways out is employing more people, 23,000 to be specific. Another one is to accelerate the electronic monitoring so that it deals with overcrowding and it's labor, it's not labor intensive. They're talking about maximizing the current facilities like the workshops and so on to help with the reskilling and so on. And they're talking about the implementation of bargaining council resolutions so that we are not, on the one hand, saying it's the year of the official and on the other hand, letting them get away with that. I was just intrigued when you said that sometimes circumstances would allow somebody to be drunk on duty. But that's fine. So those are the type of... You said take too much look at the circumstances. I don't say because of the circumstances it allows for you to be drunk. Okay, no, but whatever it is, I wish there was nothing with members of parliament that some of us could be allowed to do that. But those are the type of things. I'm asking this because I know Lucas is the next one to talk. And I know you're firm proponent against increasing numbers. I know that, so I want you to raise those things. But over and above everything else they've said, we're not saying yes or no anyway. It's about helping us. But I mean, these are the four that seem to be members coming out of the presentations that we will consider. So let's head over to you, Mr. Mujing. And it is 20 past. Down about 22, I think we'll ask you to something that we'll engage with your presentation. Thank you, Chairman. I beg your pardon, I'm sorry. So it indicates that the East Key might get cold, but those that go enjoy tea, please do so in the order fashion. Might get cold. If you want to have tea, we'll have a working arrangement. Thank you, Mr. Mujing.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to the committee members. If I look at the overall strategic plan, my main critique is that it's not really a strategic plan. It is a listing of targets, but it does not really tell us what is it that the department is going to do to achieve those targets. So, for example, there is a target on reducing assaults. But how is this going to happen? That my problem with it, because it becomes very opaque planning process. How can we assess if the budget is being used appropriately and efficiently if we don't know what it is actually going to be used on? And that's the thrust of at least the first part of the submission.
So we can answer that we're all on the same page. Have you looked at the annual performance plan? Because my understanding was that a threat there, which says this is where we're going to go in 5 years or ever long. Then there's an ADP that says this is how we will start getting there. In other words, on a 12-month basis. Are you sticking by your story saying that doesn't seem to be coming through? Because otherwise, I have to say that threat plan is the wish list with no indication as to the how. I thought the threat plan was the wish list, and the ADP was the how. That's how I understood it. Maybe I'm wrong, we will interrogate them tomorrow on that one. Are you suggesting that even with both these documents, you still think that it's just really a bit of a heavy set?
Yes, Chairperson, it's a similar listing of targets, but after explaining that, use it, assaults as an example. For example, if you say we're going to train all 40,000 employees on the absolute tradition of torture, and we're going to do that every month, and so on, so I'm just using an example, and that does not come out. So the submission deals with the alignment between the strategic plan and the budget, secondly creating safer prisons, safer institutions, and then lastly with rehabilitation and reintegration. I'm not going to go through this verbatim. It's a long submission, so I'll just highlight some of the key issues. So the first point we're making is that in respect of access to education, there is indeed stagnation in the performance of the department. And I went back to the 1997 annual report of the department and found there that a total of 21,391 prisoners, as shown in Table 1 on page 6 of the submission, had access to education. Several years later, in 2011-12, that figure had moved up to 25,224. So that's 2,833 prisoners more with access to education. That represents roughly an increase of 1.2% of the sentence population. So not really a sense of moving forward, but what is even more concerning is that the target for the coming year, for 2013-14, as shown on page 7, table 2, is in fact a regression. The target is 19,700 people who would have access to education in the prison system. So dropping from 25,000 to 19,000. I think it's even more concerning, and this is research that we did in 2012, is that we found children of compulsory school-going age who are not having access to education. This is not a large group of prisoners, there's some 800. And one has to ask the question, even if this is a statutory requirement, it's very clear in Correctional Services Act, why are these children not in school? Then, so in view of these developments, and based on international good practice from Europe, the United States, and even from Mozambique, we are proposing that we need to look at how or the feasibility of removing the provision of education from the Department of Correctional Services and allocating that to the Department of Basic Education. Then, on page 8, deals with the allocation towards the training of staff. Whilst the department is spending 12.5 billion rand on the compensation of employees, on page 3 and 4 of the budget vote is allocated 5 million rand for training and development. That's roughly 122 rand per employee for the year ahead. So this is even more perplexing when we see that the department will spend 22 times that amount on the payment of consultants in the coming year. And we've heard what the Auditor General has said about the use of consultants and the transfers of skills. And perhaps the reason for the department's continuous reliance on consultants needs to be found in the allocation towards training, that it remains dependent on external skills. I move on to page 9. And we ask the question whether budget allocations are in fact rooted in and based on policy priorities. And the first issue I want to speak to is a question about value for money in high-tech security solutions. Now, the budget vote proposes that inmate tracking system will be developed to reduce escapes. We are not given exact amounts in the budget vote how much this would cost, but the expected result is that it will reduce escapes from a level of 54 per year to 42 per year. So that's a reduction of 12 escapes per year for an amount of money that we are not aware of exactly how much it would be. But perhaps more important is the white paper does not emphasize high-tech security solutions in its view on security, but rather emphasizes dynamic security solutions. And that means staff of the department supervising prisoners actively to ensure safety and security. That is the approach in the white paper, not purchasing expensive equipment at a very, very low return on investment. But I think it is also worthwhile to note that given the history with technology-driven solutions in this department, and I refer you specifically to the biometric security systems, but one has to seriously ask questions about the department's capability of handling these contracts.
move on to page 10 that deals with overcrowding in female facilities. Now, the white paper tells us that overcrowding is not a problem in female facilities. Well, this is actually incorrect. And we looked at the statistics from February 2011, and we found that 72% of South Africa's female prisoners are held in the facilities listed there, which are on average 175% full. So overcrowding in female facilities is a serious problem, yet we don't see any reflection of this in the budget or in the strategic plan. On page 11, the submission deals with the adequacy, or rather inadequateness, of the performance indicators in the strategic plan and the performance plan. And one example is used there, where it refers to under the program administration, and it is percentage of cases brought against the Department of Defense, and the technical description provided for this indicator sketches the situation where the department is unaware of litigation against it, primarily from parole decisions, and is therefore present in court to defend itself. The issue is not whether the department is present in court or not. The issue is whether the department is taking the necessary steps to avoid litigation in the first instance. That is what should be in the strategic plan. Similarly, the indicators dealing with community corrections deal with parole violations, how the department operates, and so on. It actually does not deal with how people are receiving reintegration support services and what the results of those support services are. That should be reflected in the map. In respect of access to health care, again, good practice advice from the World Health Organization and the UN Office on Drugs and Crime recommend that the government departments responsible for health care for the general population should also be assigned the responsibility for prison health care. We've had endless problems with prison healthcare over the last 2 decades, and I think it's time to review that. The reason for this, I set out briefly there, it relates to consistency in the implementation of national healthcare policy, also consistent training of staff, and also that medical personnel in prison facilities perform an important oversight function, and they must be able to do so independently of the prison administration. The next part about the submission deals with safe prisons. There is a fair amount of research available on what creates safe prisons. The submission deals with the absolute prohibition of torture. I'm not going to go into that. The submission also deals with steps to be undertaken by a state party to the UN Convention Against Torture and how to prevent torture and ill treatment. These steps is what one would like to see reflected in the strategic plan and budget both of the department. Regular review of policy, practice and procedure, independent oversight, effective compliance mechanism. These are all detailed in the submission. I'm not going to go through that. On page 20, the submission deals with reducing violence in prisons. And the point I really want to make is that, yes, we have gangs in our prisons, and these gangs date from back to the late 19th century. But somehow we've allowed them to remain there because they do perform an important regulatory function by controlling the use of violence in prisons. So, and I don't think everybody really understands it in that way. So it is about keeping the peace to a large extent, but it also has given the gangs a foothold. But the gangs is a slightly narrower issue in respect of overall violence and how they understand violence in a prison environment. And to blame violence merely on unruly individuals or gangs and so on, I think is an oversimplification of the problem. It has a lot to do with the management approach and the relationship between staff and prisoners on a day-to-day basis. So the research tells us that a management approach that emphasizes control and policing and regulations are not conducive to creating the safer prison. This is what the research tells us. This is not what I'm wanting here. But the research also tells us that a consensus-based approach where people are treated with respect and there's good communication, those are safer prisons. And I think one needs to approach it from that angle. So Another very important finding from the research is, and there's very solid evidence for this, is that providing prisoners with academic and vocational training programs as a means to reduce violence and disorder in prison has been shown to be extremely effective. So, the pervasive idleness and long lockup period characterizing South African prison life emerges to be one of the major risks to safe custody. In respect of rehabilitation and reintegration, I'm on page 22. I suspect Mitra is going to go into that in a lot more detail. The submission deals with the challenges faced by these prisoners. Again, it is these challenges that one would like to see reflected in the strategic plan. That is what the department must respond to. The obsession with parole violations as an indicator of performance only reflects part of the picture. So, there are also a certain number of principles for effective interventions. These are well established in the research. And have been communicated to the department ourselves on previous occasions. But what we are asking for is, how do we know that the programs the department currently provides are effective? Have they ever been evaluated? Have we seen those results? Or is it merely a case of people being put through a sausage machine with a vague hope that they will behave when they are released? And more importantly, when they are released into an environment where they receive absolutely no support services from the Department of Correctional Services, except for being cited for parole violations. So, we also submit that the department should make available funds to academic institutions and civil society organizations to develop new programs, implement them, and also subject them to rigorous violations. We need to open the field and allow organizations and individuals to experiment, to be innovative around how we deal with our offender reentry program. There is a earlier decision reflecting an annual report of the department that steps are underway to support non-governmental organizations financially for the services they render in support of the department's mandate. I'm not sure that that decision has gone any further. But we do see in the field I work in that organizations are under extreme financial pressure. Large organizations have had to retrench staff, large numbers of staff, yet there remains the expectation that the whole society will continue to support the mandate of the Department of Correctional Services. But this is not a very equal relationship. Then lastly, the Social Reintegration Program. The targets in the strategic plan, with perhaps the exception of the one relating to a halfway house, they do not really relate to the substance of the program. They relate to how the department monitors parolees, how the department functions internally, and how they're going to promote non-custodial sentencing. The question therefore remains, what will the department do in practice facilitate reentry and reintegration as determined by the challenges faced by internal prisoners? And a number of recommendations are made there based on research that we've done. Very often prisoners are not informed of what resources are available when they are released from prison. We think there should be a much closer cooperation between the Department of Correctional Services and the provincial departments of social development as well as local government authorities to facilitate access to services or even job opportunities. Just one point in respect of halfway houses. This was an initiative announced 2 years ago. We're going to go and look what the research findings are, the recent research findings from the Department of Corrections in Pennsylvania found that there is no noticeable difference in the rearrest rate of people released to their homes, right? Or those released to halfway houses. So we are asking questions around the appropriateness of this initiative. If the department can demonstrate that they'll run it in a way that will make a difference, of course, based on evidence one can support such a decision. But if it's merely a public relations exercise, then I think one needs to reconsider. Chairperson, I'll stop there. Thank you.
However, I want to highlight two issues just getting to be on it. Firstly, the question of halfway houses, I hear that all the caveats that you're expressing on this, there is only one in existence at the moment and situated in the urban area. But what do you do, for example, of somebody who has got an address, for example? Is this not the place where you can in fact release somebody on parole, where you would otherwise not be able to release them on parole because they have a verifiable address? But more particularly, what are your views on people who have had skills development while they've been in prison, and that one can use these halfway houses as a way of actually utilizing those skills in a controlled environment, so that you can actually then launch people more effectively or more successfully into society, and particularly I'm thinking here about agricultural skills. You had a sort of a halfway farm, if you like, where you could actually introduce people into society by allowing those people to utilize the skills they developed in prison in a pre-market environment. But the more particular question I'd like to ask is your criticism about inmate tracking. And I'm not sure what the department was referring to when they were referring to this aspect of inmate tracking, but what are your views about inmate tracking devices, particularly used for probationers and parolees, a mechanism for tracking people, and therefore perhaps allowing more people to be given community-based sentences in with the best confidence that you know that those people would adhere to the conditions. I hear the misgivings you might have about the management of technical contracts, but in principle, what is the view of your organisation to those devices? Thank you, Chair.
All right. So let me also first of all start with the point made by Mr. Staff. I was intrigued when you said that the history of technology-driven solutions is something that we're sorry about. We were talking specifically on the electronic tagging. I agree it was an innovation, but you must tell us why you have those things. Because, and you seem to say that the white people said human contact. I'm not using your words, but more human contact. Because if that's what you're saying, then I'm going to lose the fight about CCTV itself and so on. And I don't intend losing that fight. Let me put it in that way. So when you say human contact, it's not possible to have human contact all the time. You've got so many parolees, surely they can't be human contact. If people are in town and kept running that fight, they can't be human contact. So when you say technology, I got worried, but make progress on why you say that. And let me also just indicate, Mr. Munching, that we agree with you, that the, and this is what I'm appealing to members and to parents and team that are here, when we meet you guys tomorrow, I certainly get the sense that your APP is really just motherhood. What do you guys say that don't need motherhood and honey pie? It's just nothing. I mean, you would say so many job opportunities. There's no how, where, why. So understand you're going to interrogate us. We don't think, when we're dealing with the AG's office, they were saying Treasury demands smart targets, smart, which are specific, measurable, and all those things. We don't think you've gone a long way in that regard. So we agree with you, sir, that you have to answer the question how. Just as an example to tell us, if Lucas is saying that the target for education is going down, in fact, first of all, he's got a concern that it's so little, but worse, that this year goes down according to last year's one. And at the same time, the Minister of Correctional Services getting up on a platform saying everybody that enters our facility that doesn't have grade 7 will go to grade 7. Then we have a problem with it. Because the Minister is putting pressure on you. He is saying your target is going down. How are you going to respond to those type of questions? So that's the point that we make. And then, Mr. Munching, to you specifically. So we agree with you with the determinant of the APP so that it can improve. You seem to be saying, Mr. Munting, that healthcare is a concern, and we agree with you. But you're not saying to us, what are the effects of overcrowding or understaffing? You know, my view is that since we deal with overcrowding and understaffing, all these other things are not going to materialize. Whether it's rehabilitation, until we can get that balance right. Or are you saying that the 41,000 people should be able to improve the healthcare? They never asked to be released, but I'm assuming that they've gone. You seem to suggest to us, Mr. Munting, that as opposed to what the PSA guys are saying, that violence is not gang driven. The guy's last statement to us was, nobody other than a gang member purposely violent. That's what he said to us. You seem to be suggesting that no, they're not the majority. Or the main part of it is more a staff for management function. Please talk to us about those things. And then, of course, our warehouses and stuff and such. So if you can just talk to some of those things. Otherwise, thank you very much for coming in. I think members will go through it and use it as preparation for tomorrow and for our budget speech. But if you could just ask them some of those things, sir. Thank you.
Thank you. In respect of the halfway houses, there's some concerns about how one operates them and what our expectations are of them. The big fear around halfway houses is that you export that prison culture into a facility, whether it's a halfway farm or a large residential facility. So now you have that prison culture sitting in the community. And that can become a very destructive influence. So whether we should copy exactly the same way that these things are operated in Australia or England or wherever, I'm not convinced. I think one needs to experiment and evaluate and see what works and what doesn't work before we go headlong into a thing that can just backfire on us. So, yes, there are people who are released without address confirmation, or could be released, except that their addresses cannot be confirmed. And maybe it is a case of linking that up with the electronic monitoring of parolee and probationers, which is something different from the inmate tracking. But in principle, I would think if it is properly managed, the inmate probationer and parolee electronic monitoring can be done well, and it can be done in a way that it ultimately saves the taxpayer money and makes DCS job easier. But I think by the same token, we must not think that electronic monitoring now replaces all the social reintegration services that are still needed and required. It is merely just to see where the person are if they don't have a stable address. They still require the necessary support services, and wearing a monitoring bracelet or device is not going to prevent somebody from committing a crime. That is just not going to happen. They will do it if they want. I can look further into it and come back to the committee, but the research tells us that intensive supervision and monitoring often has a negative impact on reoffending rates. I'm not aware of a study that links that specifically to electronic monitoring, but I can go look at it and come back to the committee to see if there is evidence in that regard. Ms. Charles, in terms of skill development and linking that halfway houses, I come to my previous point and say, well, let's experiment, let's innovate, let's try things, and sometimes we'll burn our fingers and sometimes it will be successful. But I think we are in a position where we keep on doing the same thing, expecting a different result. And that is just not going to fly. I've spoken about the issue about the inmate tracking devices. Those are for the internal...
Sorry, Mr. Munting. Just on the previous one, I was checking it. Maybe you must help us with that discussion. Parolees are the ones that will have the electronic tagging. You're indicating that that tagging alone will not assist in rehab. I agree with you. The
question that I'm asking, if Indy, we're not sure, those parolees, and maybe Mr. Sarah, if you can help, but those parolees, in reality, do they get any rehab other than going to sign a register every week or every month? I mean, what was the intention and what is the reality? Was the intention that when he goes on parole that he must still continue anger management or whatever it is? Or, so, to my understanding right now, other than if he has, I don't know, to call it correctional supervision, all he does is just sign on a Monday or on a Wednesday, and that is basically what he's going to do until his 5 years or whatever parole is up and in time. That's how it works very much, isn't it?
I think that's how it works in fact. I think that's not how it's supposed to work in fact. Well, but for example, community service is often a component of parole, and that there are various behavioural requirements.
Yes.
The tracking devices could indeed determine whether or not, for example, if one of your conditions of parole is house arrest, whether you're not at your house. It's very simple. And then someone can be sent down to picture and take that to prison. So it depends entirely on what stage you are in the parole regime as to the success of whether those tracking devices could be used optimally. But I still remain convinced that they're better than nothing and that they will release correctional officials to intervene more where they need to intervene instead of just doing routine checks.
Sorry, would you come back to Terrence? Correctional services. Parole, is there anybody that gets parole condition that says you must go to anger management class or that only you mustn't drink, don't smoke, house arrest? Has anybody had parole condition that forced him to some sort of a rehab? And what examples are there that people do that? I mean, I know that they'll say you shouldn't drink while you're on parole, don't smoke, and of course maybe that don't go to this place, which will help. But if it says you must go to this pastor every day to read the Bible so that you can heal yourself, how do you guys accept that? Or is that left up to the inmates to rehabilitate himself? Because I'm thinking of somebody that is a 15-year sentence. After 7 years he comes out. And we get told by yourself that no, actually doesn't mean that the sentence is over. It just means the other 7 years is going to be doing outside. Does physical, actual parole stop when he leaves the door? That's the question I'm asking. And if it doesn't stop, how do you monitor that it continues? Does it happen? Because then your question is very relevant. Why is electronic monitoring just to hurt him as a cattle and not get anything else for him? You understand where we're going, because it becomes a very expensive exercise if it's only to make sure that he's there, but not to make sure that he gets what he would have got if he was inside. In fact, they need to stay inside and complete the whole treatment. I mean, that could be the other side of the argument. Anyhow, the council please bring them tomorrow, because we'll raise them tomorrow. What are we benefiting other than being able to track some of these by doing electronic monitoring? I think that's the question.
Thanks, Chairman. We may not have the specific details at this stage, but there are mechanisms that are in place. Remember, as you indicated, that it does not in any way suggest that when a person is outside, doesn't require such program. But we may not have sufficient capacity to deal with that adequately. Hence, in the event where the person renegades or breaches the parole conditions, goes back. Where the issue of partnership with other stakeholders may actually kick in, you know, to assist in this regard, like NICROs and other organizations. But I've taken note of that, and the content specialist also would be able to come in handy in the area of health concern.
Right. So
please ask
a very last question. I mean, we are busy rolling it out now. And if the value add is only for tracking and not for rehab, then we might have to reconsider it. So tomorrow when we ask you to present, please give us some sort of value add more than just tracking with the electronic. Thanks for wanting. Sorry about that.
No problem, Chair. Yeah, I mean, just to come back to this point,
prison prior to release. But if you do not support that with support services post-release, the chances are very good that you're going to undo in a very short period a very expensive investment. And this is the sorry state of this budget, is that it's 4% allocated to reintegration. That is probably the most important part of the budget in terms of looking at strategically, because we must ask the question, how does the department contribute to public safety? At the moment, they dump people on the streets without any support services. Parole is nothing more than a policing function where people sign in and so on. There may be a few instances where they get good support services, but it's definitely not the norm. Mr. City, I've been asking whether people are instructed to attend certain programs and services. I'm not even sure that sentence remarks by presiding officers are properly communicated to DCS to ensure that this person, if the presiding officer says, I think you should attend an anger management program, that is in fact implemented. Because the transcripts do not necessarily come from the Department of Justice to DCS. So even if the court has good intentions, these are lost. On the inmate tracking devices, our critique really is that, firstly, we don't know how much money this is going to cost, but these things are generally not cheap. The result is that the case will reduce from 54 to 42 per year. That's 12 escapes less. I'm sure we can live with that, especially if staff are better trained to implement dynamic security measures and actively supervise prisoners instead of locking themselves and walking away. And we find situations where one or two officials are in charge of 300, 600 prisoners. And I think at some cities, even a higher ratio than that. It's impossible to maintain security there. So I think we must be very careful when we look at technology-driven solutions and really ask the question, are they based on policy decisions? Are they really going to give us the best results over the long term? Or are we creating officials that rely on technology to do their jobs? In terms of healthcare, and Smith, you asked a question around overcrowding and understuffing and so on. The last time I checked, the ratio for nurse to prisoner was better in prison than it is in outside society. So I don't think understaffing in terms of healthcare staff is a serious problem. We may want to have more doctors, but I think we can live with what we have at the moment. The inspector has done healthcare audits. There are a few prisons where there are notable problems, but in essence, I would say the department has the capacity to provide proper health care services. Our submission is that we don't believe that the Department of Correctional Services should render the services anymore. It should be the Department of Health, and the reasons for that is listed in the submission.
As the Department of Education
does.
In terms of overcrowding, some members may know, because we've made these submissions to the committee,
the sentence admissions are coming down. They've dropped by 50% over the last 6 years. So our sentence population has remained stable. They're just being sentenced for longer and longer, and that's why stability is there. The awaiting trial population has remained relatively stable, but it's a very large proportion of the total prison population. And that is the issue of concern, because that there are so many of them, but also that more than half of them have been in custody for longer than 3 months. And we need to go back to police and ask the question, why is the police arresting 1.4 million people a year, of whom the majority are arrested for non-priority crimes? These are crimes that are less serious than shoplifting. And surely some of them find their way into DCS facilities. But unless we address the problem at that end, and we prevent that the criminal justice system is filled up with nonsense cases, with petty cases, we're going to continue seeing people sitting excessively long periods in DCS facilities whilst they're waiting for their trials to be completed.
Non-powerful crowding. It's either the SAS and or a port. And just to add to that, this research that was done some 3 years ago that found that half of the people who are awaiting trial now will be released without their cases going to trial. So they've based the taxpayer money, the state never had a case against them, and ultimately after 3 or 4 months they are the case scrapped on the roll or the prosecution withdraws. So the overcrowding problem is at this stage a very well studied problem, but somehow the different players are not making the links to ensure that we actually bring the population down. Thank you.
Quick follow up. I'm intrigued with the idea of outsourcing health and education services. And you also are calling for support of NGOs to deliver the entry services, which you very eloquently said are being delivered by the CSI. The question I would want to ask is, what is DCS, in your view, actually delivering? I mean, are they just warehousing people? Are they just providing security services? Because they're not providing rehabilitation, or re-entry, or health, or education. What are they providing?
Thank you, Chakasim. My question, Chakasim, is on the programs that are outside when the inmate is out. I want to know that as NGOs, what are the programs do they have and the relationship between them and the correctional cities. I'm sure Che maybe is going to answer what you have saying right now, that when the inmate is out with a parole, that inmate is only out on the responsibility of the inmate is only going to sign, and we don't get a clear picture that there are problems for them when they're out. Maybe that's why they go back to the prison again before their parole is finished, because there's no clear program that NGOs also, the role that they are playing in terms of maybe capacity that maybe we can say we can put more budget on the NGOs, because this is what they are doing. I wanted to get a clarity on that, Chairperson, because really we also want to see different change in terms of the inmates that are out with the parole, out of the rehabilitation that they get in our center. But when they are out, then we need to have a program that really is assisting the inmate when the inmate is out of our center, that to sign only. And maybe that's what Chairperson is going to assist us. And even themselves, if they want a budget, we know that the budget that we are putting is budget that is assisting the program of correctional safety. So Chair, I wanted to check in terms of the checking on the rural areas, that how is the system going to work on the rural thinking? Because some of them, they don't have electricity. Thank you.
Some of these questions will have to be answered by the department and not necessarily by Mundi, who is not implementing it, but if you want to, it's fine. But Harrison, then you'll respond, Mr. Mundi.
Yeah, quickly, I just want to ask this person, Dr. Mundi. Will he support the notion, in terms of Section 60 of the Criminal Procedure Act, the police officers are only compelled to testify to oppose bail. Otherwise, they just arrest the arrest, doesn't matter what, where the person arrested ends up, you know, whether the case was frivolous or under a horrendous crime or released afterwards, they don't care. They just arrest. Would he support this there's a school of thought which suggests that in any arrest, when a police officer arrests, that police officer must go in a swinging court. Just to turn that thing around. To make an arrest more, place an obligation on a police officer when there is an arrest executed, that he or she must appear in court to explain to the necessity of that arrest. Other than to pump the child school and got 1.4 million in the child, some of them came up in the correction service of the city, others were raped and assaulted while they, on the Monday, there's no case against them. Just to avoid this abuse and make it more, to legitimize more the arrest in the circumstances. Would you support the one show view about it? Thanks.
Thank you. Mr. Self, I suppose one can be doesn't say I don't know what they do. I think there's a lot of administration taking place. There's a lot of sentence plans being pulled out. But a sentence plan does not mean that the services will actually be rendered. And if the figures we submitted in the submission on access to education and training, we're saying, well, the target is 20,000. I'm not too sure that there is a high level of productivity. And even some of the other programs, where the targets and the outputs are frankly very, very low. They're not very impressive. But by the same token, some of the committee members may have visited Bansai youth prison outside Worcester. I was there some 12, 18 months ago. And it's an extremely well-run facility that have, for both children and juveniles, everybody's attending school, there's a band, they go canoeing on Bansai Dam. It's an extremely well-run facility. In the same management area is Halkwa, where there are absolutely no services for children and juveniles. And you ask yourself a question, how could there be such differences in implementation in the same organization that is subject to the same legislation and the same policies? What makes the difference? And I don't know. I think it's individual managers. Then, Mandwenya, the first release support services, I think organizations like NIPA can talk more to than I can. But I think in terms of NGO contribution, I think we have to acknowledge firstly there are roughly about 4,000 sentence releases per month. Now we're not even talking about people who've spent a year awaiting trial and then coming out who need exactly the same type of services. I would say there are roughly in the region of about 20, if maybe even less, NGOs in South Africa that run post-release support services. So this is a very small group of people who are operating on a shoestring budget that do not receive funding from the Department of Correctional Services. They may receive funding from local authorities or from the provincial Department of Social Development. I'm thinking of one particular example here in Cape Town, an organization by the name of Realistic that runs support services in conjunction with community corrections from Mitchell's Plain. And that is a very productive relationship that I think is a model that one needs to look at, where you link up specific non-governmental organizations with DC Concord offices to ensure that there is a follow-through in terms of services. On the inmate tracking, parolee tracking in rural areas, I think the department must respond to that. Ms. Max, in terms of policemen testifying, whether they in court, my immediate reaction would be, you know, all our policemen would be permanently in court testifying. That would be wonderful. But I think part of the problem is the high volume of arrests. And if one can bring that down by removing the arrest targets from the police's performance targets, then it may actually be a workable solution. But I need to think about it more, and maybe we can come back to the committee on that. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. We shall use your input, sir, when we deal with the department tomorrow and Thursday. argue our case on the 29th. So members are free to continuously interact with the authors of these documents because it's intended to help us all the way to the 29th, I think, about it. It is step of 12, we've got 20 minutes for last detention, and we're not saying that you must use 20 minutes if you can deal with it in a shorter time or better, and then we will follow Nikra. Last detention.
Hi, I'm Emily from Strong Agenda Justice, but I wasn't able to come today from just attention. And I will be able to keep it quite brief. So I'm here representing a partnership between Strong and Just Attention International. We're working to end sexual abuse in DCF facilities and promote health rights of inmates, focusing particularly on HIV. Both of these are widespread problems that have been discussed quite extensively by this committee. The high levels of recidivism and, you know, high numbers of people cycling in and out of prison each year mean the trauma and impact of rape and HIV in prison has a direct impact on all of us. So we'll be speaking, our commission quite brief, but we'll just be speaking to portions of the strategic plan and annual performance plan that pertain to these issues. So first and foremost, despite increasing evidence base that developed over the years on the prevalence of sexual abuse in prisons, including substantial claims that are brought into the department on an annual basis, cost the department quite a lot of money, this topic remains completely invisible in the strategic plan and the annual performance plan. It's not mentioned anywhere. And this is a grave concern to us, and we think that the plan should, at the very least, set specific targets for the reduction of sexual abuse, which are non-existent. More generally, statistics on reported rapes and sexual assaults of inmates in DCF facilities remain completely unavailable to the public. So this is despite assurances from the department and numerous calls from civil society to make this information publicly available. So this is something we've raised to you in the past couple of years. It's still a challenge we're facing. At present, sexual assault and rape is still merged into the general assault category. Obviously, these should be disaggregated and reported as a separate category to start to understand the problem more deeply and to identify it as a worthy and deeply serious issue. And to establish a basis from which to measure its true prevalence. These are, you know, basic requirements in order to start taking critical steps to address these issues. We also urge the framework to address sexual abuse of inmates in DCF facilities to be highlighted as one of the plan's policy initiatives in the strategic plan and annual performance plan. It's not there. This is despite the draft being finalized in December 2010, so that's 2.5 years ago. It's still not mentioned as a policy priority. In March this year, we, Monke and JDI, did have a promising meeting with senior management at the DCF head office, and there they made commitment to see through that framework is adopted. But we think this should at least highlight it inside the planning documents to support these efforts and to prioritize it. In addition to this, the strategic plan and the performance plan do mention the amendments that were brought forth in the Correctional Matters Amendment Act, but in there also the provision that requires the development of a screening tool to assess newly sentenced inmates for vulnerability to sexual abuse is not mentioned, again, despite this being one of the key changes that were brought forth in that act. So again, this should be mentioned. We echo CSPRI's concerns around the lockup practice, the minimal inmate supervision, and the poor responses to emergencies, and note that these things are not highlighted as issues in either document at all. The staffing crisis that leads scales of staffing in many facilities, resulting in only cursory monitoring of inmates for long periods of time, is a serious issue, and as noted many times by members of this committee, response processes in cases of emergency are typically lengthy, cumbersome, and often fatal. We note that there are efforts underway between DCS and organized labor to negotiate the proper implementation of the seven-day establishment, but nowhere does it note a need to address lockup as part of the solution, and we think that should be part of the conversation. And in our experience, so this practice of extended lockup, combined with the substantial challenges staff face in dealing with emergencies, puts inmates at greatly increased risk of violence. It causes immense stress for staff and inmates and contributes to staff demoralization. So in a year of the correctional official, we think it would be apt to focus on it in those plans. We also think that HIV policy should be reviewed, and that should be listed as one of the policy priorities in both documents. The existing one is 2005, it's quite out of date, and also does need to make note of distribution of lubricants, which would increase the cost effectiveness of distributing condoms, because without lubricants, condoms will tear during anal intercourse and make condoms largely inefficient in prevention. We do welcome the inclusion of plans to improve the systems and policies of remand detention. We think it's urgently required. In this regard, we just want to steer the committee and DCS to research recently completed by Death Detention International, which would assist in some of these endeavors. The research looks at staff handling of violence in sections where they work, reveals crucial issue for attention in the management of remand detainees, and that currently jeopardize inmate and staff safety. This report has been submitted to DPS and is a pending publication. I think those are the main things I'll highlight. Looking back to the earlier discussions about staffing levels and ratios, I just want to note that I think it's really critical to understand what exactly is happening on the ground. We are currently undertaking research to assess the actual staffing situations in select prisons. So we're doing an empirical study to assess current DCS security and custodial staff levels and requirements. We'll be examining how staff are deployed at select prisons, how staff are allocated, what their duties are, and we'll also look at how the seven-day establishment and actual systems affect staffing. So in preparation for this research, we did some very crude analysis, and what might initially appear as a 1-to-4 ratio quickly becomes something much less favorable. You know, at any given time, even if you're using a seven-day establishment, half the staff will be off-duty. And because of the lockup system, you can assume that probably around three-quarters of staff would be allocated today's shift, a quarter to night shift. So using basic calculations based on that, the ratio of staff to inmate ratio during the day would be probably on an average of 1 to 12. At night, it would be an average of 1 to 37. This would be made worse in incentives where there are problems of absenteeism, suspension, and sick leave, which have all been noted to be serious problems. So I would just say that it's crucial to understand what the actual situation is on the ground in order to assess what needs to happen to improve it, whether that's deployment, how that redeployment needs to happen. Thank you very much.
Any good? Let's decide for Saints, Longoria, then Mr. Self, and then Mr. Max. And then Goody.
Thank you, Captain. And also thank you for the presentation. Captain, the document check, it shows that there's a lot that needs to be reviewed, that's one. Secondly, on the abuse of sexual abuse on the center. I don't know whether it's the answer, but I've got the concern of this sexual abuse. Most of the inmates that are coming in the center, okay, when we go to oversight, are rapists. And they are young. Now, okay, I wanted to check everything with something. That what are the problems do they have outside? Because this stigma is starting from before going to the center. And when you look at the stigma of rapists, instead of going down, it's increasing. It's now attacking old ladies. is now attacking small children, 2 years children, 5 years children. So, Chair, if we do have a leg inside in the center, why we don't have a leg outside? If that leg is not there now, but because it's something happens that is affecting our country, I think a NGO needs to think broader than inside them only. So I want to get their view, Chair, on that. Thank you, Chair. But the document, Chair, is fine. We got lots of questions that we can take from this document and give it to them as the department. In terms of myself, I don't have much questions on that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Chair. My observation, I suppose, fit in the neatly with the last part of what Winnie said. I mean, I would want the department to come tomorrow, ideally, and to answer the question about why it is that there are no measurements for sexual abuse, or why those never feature in annual reports or AEP. Secondly, what is the blockage? The implementation of the framework to address sexual abuse of inmates, and thirdly, whether the screening tool for identifying vulnerable inmates has been developed, and if not, why not, and if so, when. So very specifically, I would like those questions answered tomorrow, if the Parliament could make a note of that.
Have you
done it?
You've taken over. Yes.
I just want to ask the presenter whether paragraph 6 on page 3 of your presentation is not going to encourage sexual abuse.
Say again?
Is not going to encourage.
Paragraph 6.
On page 3 of our presentation.
Right.
Actually, it's supposed to be paragraph 7 or something. 7 or something. 7, 6, and then 8. Thank you.
Society is an important point and one that we agree with. and you know, Spokane, that's something that we focus on as an organization. We work with men and boys to prevent gender-based violence, to discuss issues of sexual violence, and to try to challenge social norms that facilitate sexual abuse in the wider community. As part of that, we start to work in prison to try to prevent sexual violence that happens in prison, because you know, it's absolutely linked to gender-based violence in our wider community, and the sexual abuse that happens inside prisons is very much gendered. And we'd be happy to come in and share more information with that to the committee. I won't go into the details about that now. So yes, we do offer services to how to address GBV and sexual violence in the wider community, as do a lot of other organizations. But what doesn't exist is the services for inmates, both non-detained and sentenced offenders. And those survivors are very much invisible inside prison, and even more so when they return to the community because of all the additional stigma that they suffer and discrimination as ex-offenders. So that one is focusing on what's happening or not happening inside prison. In terms of tangible programs, yes, we do offer tangible programs. We developed a training guide specifically for working with DCS members on how to address HIV and sexual abuse, and it provides grounding in gender, HIV basics, as well as the laws and policies say, and as well as you know, workshop activities to brainstorm how to address it concretely inside the prison they work in according to the protocols of that prison. And that's something we've been doing on an ad hoc basis throughout the Haoteng region and the Western Cape. And at present, we're negotiating an MOU to roll it out from the directorship down to every single staff member in the Haoteng region. So, you know, it really depends on which region you're talking to in terms of how proactive they'll be with it. At the national level, that same type of proactive approach hasn't been, we haven't experienced that yet. We're hoping that our recent negotiations with head office, senior management head office, will lead to a similar plan for national rollout of training for staff on this. Because it's not part of the core training that staff receive. And very often, whenever we do these trainings, we receive feedback saying, thank you, we want to know more, don't know what to do about it. So we do offer those services. And I think my response indeed to the questions around point six would align with what Chairperson Smith said. Indeed, it's something that DCS is obligated to do, to provide condoms and lubricants as part of the National Strategic Plan for HIV and AIDS, which highlights inmates as a key population and states specifically that there need to be measures to stop sexual abuse inside prisons, in order to stem the spread of HIV and widen into wider society, and that condoms and lubricants are part and parcel of that, of that effort. And indeed, it will happen whether you want it to or not. And not all intercourse that happens in prison is non-consensual. Some people do have consensual sex. That's something that happens when, you know, there's only one sex, you know, confined in a space like that. It's just something that's documented throughout the world. So whether you want it to happen or not, it will. The point is to make it safer and to lessen the impact it has on the wider society. Thank you.
Good afternoon, members and stakeholders in the chief. These two documents impact one is a more comprehensive document and going much more rigorously into rehabilitation and evidence-based practice, and include all of that in the PowerPoint submission because I'm going to touch on them. So I'm assuming that members, when they have the time to read through that, will do so. Chair, to start off in my introductory comments, I think I mentioned this in the previous subject discussion, where we offer the opportunity to input when the allegations and surely are done to various departments. And just to say how we can use this information policy that we're deliberating over here to inform that process. Because when it comes here, it's actually quite late to influence the major movement with regard to crisis. And so at some point, I know we did say in committee calendar we can put you know, deliberating to that end before the legislative process and how we can use what we use for this. Well, we really know.
Before you carry on, we agree. We're also arguing that rather than giving it to us, but in the parliament, struggling to be able to influence what happens there. So once we work out this whole budget and appropriations process, then we will have a meaningful discussion. Otherwise, we'll be sharing with us, we have nowhere to take it.
Thank you. Well, I think we know the budget when it comes to collections, and I think we were concerned when we discussed that 15 billion, and now it's in 2015-16, it's projected to be 20 billion. And I think also agreed that it is not sustainable that the collection services budget continues to grow at such a rapid rate, and that we have to relook at how we can do more with less. And I think that's, of course, that's said in the forward of the strategic plan, and I think that's coming from Treasury to all government departments, and it's something we need to look at seriously when we look at restructuring the collection services budget. And I think what my presentation is going to focus on, we talked a lot about reintegration and rehabilitation. But I think from a budget perspective and from a spending perspective, it is very important to know how do we reduce spending in correctional services by focusing actually on rehabilitation and reintegration. Because if you have effective, and that people will show that if you have effective evidence-based rehabilitation services and you do proper reintegration, less people are likely to come back into the system. My understanding, I know Lucas has mentioned that sentencing has dropped in terms of the number of people coming to prison, but I think there are still large numbers of people coming to prison. And I may not have the official statistics, but I believe a lot of them are reoffending. And that's because we're failing at rehabilitation and we're failing at reintegration. And I think we need to be smart around what we do with less and how we work more collectively together. And I think one of the solutions, we talked about electronic monitoring and a more comprehensive approach, and I think it will support that. I think in previous submissions we've talked about the technology being not sufficient to avoid the process. And to tell you from a realistic perspective, I sit there and it's frustrating check in dealing with the offenders that do come up. We see how they struggle. They struggle first because some of them have never had access to rehabilitation in prison. And when they come out, they struggle with having been institutionalized, they struggle with reintegrating into their families. And what I'm showing here is that rehabilitation is linked to reintegration. If you don't do it well in prison, you're not going to likely succeed. It's like working at that end and trying to undo everything that has been done. They've committed the offense, they've gone into an institution, that institution itself has been detrimental, has caused more harm. And then you come back and you're dealing with reintegration, not only from your criminal behavior to pro-social behavior, you're dealing with all the harmful impacts of incarceration. So it makes sense that at the front end, we need to do something effectively. Because this does not make sense that we will continue, and we will continue to spend on corrections. I do not believe we need more staff, but I do believe that right now, because overcrowding is so great, maybe there's other solutions. I agree with you. If we move the partnership approach, I believe maybe we can bring in contracted people for a certain amount of time so we can get the rehabilitation part right. If we say, and my paper looks at evidence-based rehabilitation practice, and I'll also show you in Africa what the regional instruments are saying about it, but if we focus on that eventually, it may be a phased approach, because it's a long term, we need to look at a long term strategy. We can't look at something that is just focusing on operations from year to year, and unfortunately that's what I see the strategic planning is. I don't know, I know the white paper is a long term solution, but I think in the strategy itself, like Lucas mentioned, we need more strategies within the strategy, more detail. Like we said, the gang management strategy, we need more details for that. The sexual offences, abuse in prisons, HIV, I mean, these are the kinds of, there are some that we need to deliberate more on them. And I think we all agree that the budget is skewed, but it's going to take a radical turnaround, and we have to look at how we can incrementally get to that point. Right now, we're not getting there. I really think we need to deliberate how do we get to evidence-based practice and rehabilitation, what it costs, and how we are going to implement it incrementally over time. The year of the correctional official is wonderful, and I think there's been ample discussion here about how to do what best we can do with declaring this the year of the official. And Chair, you're right. I mean, look at them to the training of officials, and we don't know what that ban is. How do we, officials are meant to be rehabilitated, every official. How do we make sure that in the year of official, that it's not amounts to events that cost us huge amounts of money, that do nothing to change the attitude to build the skills and competency of correctional officials, and to deal with stress of officials, to deal with, I think it's a really comprehensive plan that's needed, because staffing is a key resource in the whole rehabilitation and correctional management. I've covered a lot in the front end, so I will, some slides I won't go for the detail, but basically looking at rehabilitation, the definition of rehabilitation is a planned intervention which aims to bring about change in some aspect of the offender that targets specifically the offender's criminality, his attitude, his cognitive processes, his personality, and mental health. It is said that rehabilitation treatment programs can include educational, vocational training, individual and group counseling, and medical treatment. So basically, if we're looking at rehabilitation, these are the elements and the components that we should be targeting. They're not just ad hoc skill training here, and that's sometimes what I see it as. It's very fragmented, and we need to look at more evidence-based practice on this. With regard to rehabilitation and reintegration of offenders in Africa, there's little information on prisons in Africa and not much research, which means we need to increase that. But like South Africa, in Africa it's dominated by descriptions of poor, overcrowded conditions, brutality and suffering, so we're not alone in that. Very little discussion on what can be done, however, to facilitate change in the inmates with a view to helping them lead cramped lives upon release. And I think that's key if we're looking at rehabilitation, but I think we're still focusing on the we need to focus on the humane treatment, but I think we mustn't leave out the psychosocial aspects of change, which sometimes often get taken off the agenda. But yet, I think we agree in Africa, rehabilitation and reintegration is key. But regional questions, I'm just going to take you through some of them. And I'm linking this to why we need evidence-based practice. I think we need to know that we need scientific evidence to show us what has worked. And numerous studies all over the world that have shown what works in terms of properly managing a correctional environment and then rehabilitating and reintegrating offenders. We cannot ignore that, no matter where they come from in the world. And I think what you'll see in the instruments is in African deliberation around, they have looked at evidence-based practice, but they've incorporated it in a very fragmented way. And alluding to it, but not doing sufficient to entrench it into policy. So, the Kampala Declaration on Prison Conditions talks about, as I mentioned here, the detrimental effects of imprisonment. And as I talk about institutionalization, should be minimized. The prisoners do not lose their self-respect and sense of responsibility. And I want to pick up on a key issue in the terms of their sense of self-responsibility. Institutionalization, what we're finding, and I know, Emily, we had a discussion about it in reintegrating offenders, they are not empowered to make decisions. We've been in a prison for 20 years and we were told what to do. You struggle to make a decision about your own life. The other day I had such an argument with an offender. He wanted accommodation and he said, what can you do? How can you help me get the accommodation? And I had to ask him, what are you going to do? So what is your plan in your mind for your life? Where do you, how, what are you going to do to get it? We can facilitate and help you along the way. But it's just the thinking. And this is what we're reintegrating back into our society. We should. There's another focus on the regional instruments that talk about civic education, becoming a proper citizen, and bringing the more pro-social aspect. We find offenders coming out of prison even worse, and they get reintegrated back into a society where they need to function and they cannot function. So although these things are all in principle, we know the progressive process to realize them. Key and important to rehabilitation and reintegration, and Nico's been talking about this for years, is families and offenders. And I do not think the DCF focused sufficiently on that. And when you're talking about these principles that have been integrated into a plan, it must run all the way through the plan. So I know the issue with counselors, offenders are counselors all the time. The implications it has on families, I've been dealing with families for the past 17 years. They cannot access the people in prison. They have to travel far distances. They are impoverished even from their family leaving the home. They battle, mothers especially, trying to get to prisons that are outlined. there's no provisions provided for supporting and giving them transport. I mean, NICRA were doing that for some time, offered a bus service, but even us in Prioritize, we had to cut that down because we did not have funds for it. But this is a practical implication, and it does. Then if you are apart from your family, what we dealing with on the back end now with reintegration is huge complex family problems. Family is not one sum of the agendas back into their family or community later on. That's why they end up on the street or not having accommodation or going to live with antisocial peers where the criminal getting into crime happens all over again. They will tell you they feel they need to be removed from those communities, those of them where something has shifted. But it's not made practical for them to do that. If they have done for 20 years work with the offender and his family, we have far greater chance that he would be reinstated than if we try to do it at a pre-release stage, which is 12 months after and before. So I think really we have not closed that together. In the white paper I looked at, it does not properly integrate evidence-based practice into it. There are certain things that are shown to work and we need to really look at that. Research has shown that time and time again. The access to education and skills, we know that that's not all the agendas at the moment, and we hope that that would increase. As the group has mentioned, it's actually been reducing rather than increasing. In the Ogudugu Declaration, they also talked about rehabilitation and, reintegration. And they also stipulated rehabilitation programs focusing on, that's an interesting point. They made the point that if you include rehabilitation programs, you do rehabilitation with an end in mind, which is properly integrated. I think the most comprehensive is the plan of action of the Ogudugu Declaration, and where it promotes rehabilitation and development programs. And interestingly enough, South Africa doesn't have those decisions. It says that unsentenced prisoners should have access to programs. Now, we know in the Lamont detention, they would look at the court program. There's this whole argument legally that if you're not guilty, you cannot receive correctional programming. But it is an opportunity, nevertheless. Literacy and skills training is emphasized, and I think we've incorporated something that we haven't been looking at it vigorously, the civic and social education. Providing social and psychological support, we know the scarcity of resources, psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, and it's still a challenge. As long as we don't have that middle critical service, it's going to greatly impact the rehabilitation process. Social workers also play a key role in contact with families and family work when we look at that. Interestingly enough, it also talks about involving, sensitizing families and communities, but also involving communities and families in the rehabilitation and reintegration programmatic. So if you're dealing with offenders in programs, there's also components suggesting that we work with families as well. Remember, there's a lot of changes that you do for a program, but if you do not inform the family or work with them around, this is the thing that the offender would, you know, this is what the program he's been through, it causes a lot of conflict. And NICRO has always started introducing family programs for exactly that reason. And there's also a draft out on prisoners' rights and set minimum standards for treatment of prisoners, and there's a section on relocation of prisoners. Chair, to get to your point, in that regional instrument, it does say rehabilitation programs shall involve as far as possible NGOs to run schemes in prisons in cooperation with prison administration and approved religious bodies to allow free access to prisoners to defend spiritual welfare to them. And that is the Department of Correctional Services is trying in this regard, but I think unless we look at a more partnership approach, Lucas mentioned, we cannot continue to sustain ourselves towards that end. We're struggling to get funding to fund our programs, and NICRU in the very DMZ, we have to return to handle of ourselves, we very likely face the same issue of the whole organization closing. And that's the survival mode we are in at the moment. Unless we are able to, and all that expertise will go, which is something we really need to particularly look at in terms of sustainability of the services that need to continue. I mean, we see over 10,000 and sometimes 20,000 people a year, so it's quite a huge gap if we have to no longer exist. With regard to the challenges, I think it's important to look at this because it will really inform our planning and thinking. Prison systems fail specific sentence offenders. Prisoners sent for serious crimes never convicted for less. I think we've come to that point where we've tried to categorize them into medium, high, and low risk, failure to create an environment conducive to rehabilitation. So we need to look at, I know there's overcrowding at the moment, but how do we make the best of creating a conducive environment? And the correctional officials are key here in terms of people. We may not have the ideal environment, but if we treat each other inhumanely and with respect, it's one of the ways in creating that kind of environment. We know prisons are understaffed, and that has a serious effect on it. Not only on the mental health of officials as well, but also compromises safety of inmates and officials and visitors. I must tell you, there was one incident where one of another organization had to visit, and this is the impact of the shortage of staff, had to do a program in prison, and normally we would have officials with us. And this time there was no official because there wasn't enough staff. So the visiting organization had to be without an official. Which is quite dangerous to run a program. So these ad hoc incidents that do happen, I'm not saying it's consistent, but it is happening at the moment. I think the caliber of correctional official is key. The white paper on corrections has all section 8 on the ideal correctional official. And if you look at the year of the correctional official, maybe that's what the department should embrace and try to work towards. It tells you that correctional officials have to have the very same competencies and skills we instill into offenders. They should be pro-social citizens, the best citizens, actually. And interestingly, the quote is, correcting inmates is an extraordinary responsibility that needs extraordinary citizens. And we need to also look at recruitment, we need to look at professionalization of corrections. And I think when I'm talking about these, indirectly I'm talking about the prioritization in the budget. So I know we're talking about budget, but I mean, and then if we get these right, we're going to go around in circles. And also, he talked about the minister, about the attitude of officials towards inmates. And I think that's very important. If you're going to rehabilitate people, you have to empower them that have the potential to change, so that they do not come back and not treat them as animals or criminals. We've got to believe that they can get out of that situation. So most countries in Africa have this problem with professional staff, and it's going to take some time, and I think we need to be creative and share, as you have said, we've got resources in this country. We need to get them to work together, and how we can get to work together. Now just, I'm going to skip all of that and just get to the point about the evidence-based practice in a nutshell, and governments around the world, and this is important, it's on page 12 I am now, moving to align their programs and services with evidence-based practice. Evidence-based practice in rehabilitation and reintegration such that public policy and practice must be based on the best available scientific evidence in order to be effective in the achievement of its goals and to be efficient in the use of taxpayer money. So it's directly related to how we spend, and I think it's a key issue for this committee. Failure to match services to rigorous evidentiary standards not only wastes precious public resources, but can lead to an exacerbation rather than improvement of the problems and issues the government is attempting to address. I think we carry on in that non-ending cycle. So what is evidence-based practice? And I think there are some components that we are already incorporating as a department, but there are some gaps. They say evidence-based practice is that it assesses actuarial risk and needs. They categorize the offenders into low risk, medium risk, and high risk. The theory behind it is that we should be prioritizing and focusing on medium to high risk offenders. And that means maybe that's where the priority and the start is to do correctional programming with medium to high-risk offenders. They say low-risk offenders actually get worse in terms of if they do behavior change programs, for example. So these are important things to note, because otherwise we're creating more problems. It also helps us focus where our resources actually need to be. And you should be focusing on your medium to high-risk offenders. I talked about enhancing intrinsic motivation, and this is my point again, which I haven't mentioned yet. Rehabilitation should not be an option. It should be mandatory. Motivation is something we even deal with during therapeutic process. The person may not be offended, motivated to come to a program, but the program itself motivates the offender to participate. So they do have a choice to participate or not when they do this. But I don't think we should be, otherwise we are warehousing people if we're sending them and the courts are not saying that the conditions should be rehabilitation. So that's important. targeted intervention, these specifically looking at this, as a surgery, you prioritize supervision and treatment resources for high-risk offenders. Need principles, you look at criminal intent needs, what causes offenders to commit crime. And I think on the previous pages, this refers to a history of antisocial behavior that must be targeted. You've got to build non-criminal alternative behavior. It talks about antisocial personality patterns. With response to that, you've got to build problem-solving, self-management, anger management, and coping skills. It needs to target antisocial attitudes and cognition. You need to reduce antisocial thinking. You need to recognize risky thinking and feelings, and you should need to adopt an alternative identity and thinking pattern. And antisocial association and peers, which is another key thing. You need to reduce association with antisocial others. And that's actually important in your correctional management in the prison, because as I said, we're mixing people, gang and non-gang, although you're trying to separate them. But, and even on the outset, when we come out in terms of social reintegration, that's a very difficult one. Family and marital cases, that's where the needs family program, or what the response should be, is to reduce conflict within families, to build positive relationships and communication, and they impact most significantly on reintegration. Lack of employment stability, achievement, educational achievement, and that's why we increase vocational skills, see more employment stability, and increase educational achievement. Now, we see in the budget as well, there's not sufficient, it has been increasing, but 74.1% of inmates will participate in adult education and training programs. Only 1.6% of inmates are projected to participate in further education and training, and 21% in skills training. So we really need to look at it. I mean, it's one of the key criminogenic factors, but it needs to be done in combination with the other ones. We can't just do one and not the other. Lack of pro-social leisure activities. We've talked about the idleness. The pro-social leisure activities, exercise, involving inmates in sports, just making correctional environments activity-based and a buzz of activity. It is really scary. I remember going to a prison and watching inmates just stand around. It was intimidating and also very disappointing that they had an opportunity to work with, work with these inmates, get them into the labor or production workshop, but it really needs to be a buzz of activity. You cannot have inmates staying in their house, and that's why they're more likely to be conflict, they're more likely to be gang violence, they're more likely to be assault. The activity is important, but you shouldn't be doing activity to no end. It needs to be based on evidence-based practice. And in substance abuse, we don't deal with efficiency in prison. Although that stop and maybe and it deters because you don't have access to it, although they do have access to it. But some of the addiction programs are not really run in prisons. Okay. So I'll go to my recommendations. I've mentioned the correctional official and the emphasis on training. We know overcrowding. You asked the question, how can we reduce overcrowding? We can reduce overcrowding through rehabilitation, reintegration, and creating alternatives to imprisonment. Incarceration of women, I think it has been highlighted that conditions are not conducive and a proper investigation needs to be done into that and given attention as a priority group as well. Alternatives, there is a survey in there, I'm not going to go to it, but basically our public survey for alternative sentencing showed the public in support of rehabilitation and reintegration. And we found that engaging with them, when they looked at the harmful effects of imprisonment, in terms of their own safety, they're more likely to support rehabilitation and reintegration. So I think that's important to know. And NICRO continues in that to try to create more alternatives. Just then, recommendations to just summarize. I think we'd, NICRO, we'd really like to carry this committee to. I know you don't have the deliberation on white paper. It's a really look at evidence-based practice. In my comprehensive document, it is all written there in detail. And I think it's important that we continue to look at how we can incorporate that into planning and budgeting when it comes to BCS. It's no use us continuing with aimless activity if it's not based on what works. And we talked about the Treasury input. The second half of the act of the US government, the minister mentions it in the forward to the strategic plan. And he talks about how the Department of Correctional Services will incorporate principles of the Second Chances Act here. They use evidence-based practice. Also, they have an interesting mechanism around grants for NGOs. Basically, in the US, when they set up legislation, they set up a grant system to support the implementation of the legislation. And I hope that in time to come, we as a country will be able to do that. That we will resource our implementation. And that means funding of the services, whether they come from the NGOs or the government. We need to properly do that, and we need to get there over time. So it is good, and I would encourage the DCS and to have a look at that mechanism. I talked about the family strengthening program, the condition of female inmates, the correctional officials training, wellness program, stress management program. I think these are all important, and to, as well as the committee to interrogate what the plan is in this year of the official. Alternative things, I mentioned the gang management strategy again, but we still don't know what that entails, and asking for the committee to ask for it. And data coordination is what is key. Data coordination and resourcing, rehabilitation, reintegration, and correctional management. And then I think previously we mentioned the less than 24 months keep in prison, just to highlight that. Again, it's one of creating space in prison. Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Nicole. Any questions or comments? Longoria, then Mr. Lentz.
Thank you, Chairman. Also, thank you for the presentation. Chairman, on page 17, I'll pick up the support on the meeting. Okay, I want to know from Nicole, what is their relationship with the victim? Because a chapter on page 17, bullet 9 on 17. The same prison can give benefits to the input into prisoner rehabilitation needs. Deal with poor families' relationship, establish financial needs and concerns. So when I'm asking about the victim person, yesterday I was watching the TV whereby the image the victim was making the victim was talking about the inmate that has killed his brother. But how is the victim work together with the inmate that is inside? The first, the victim asked the inmate, why you were killing my brother? And the inmate said, I'll kill your brother because I'm coming from poor family. And when they make a search, they find that yes, it's true, it's like that. But the good thing that the bad guy is this victim, they were working together, especially the John Spencer. This inmate is sentenced to 27 years. But what is this victim, the bad? Is what I was expecting the micro to do it on the victim. That's why my question is based on that. What is their relationship with the victim? Because this victim said she sent his man to empower the inmate inside. You know that our inmate, they don't have resources to when they pass medicine. They don't have a resource to be taken better. But this victim makes sure that this inmate inside is getting education services and look after him and look after the family also at home. The family they are saying is saying he's sick and they are looking after the family. And he's a doctor. The victim is a doctor. So I want to know Chapasin. That what is the NICO, what is the relationship in terms of the victim, because whatever is in the treatment is talking only with the inmate. And also on the issue of housing, I want to get a clear sense that I will not go to fight with a community. community outreach that they are fighting with us right now, that before you get educated, if you want to be educated, go to the institution, then you are going to get educated. Now we are paying on point ahead. Approach support in prison, health is not at 10,000. So now we are saying the department must make sure that the image when it's out, they must get a house. I believe that this is the responsibility of the social workers that we are going to look after the image when the house starts. But if we are saying correctional things must have a budget that is going to give an image when it's out in the prison, I don't know what you mean, Jefferson. We are going to fight with the community. That's okay, I don't have a house. Let me do something. Then when I came out, I know that they are going to build a house for me. I want to try this on this one. What do they mean when they said access housing or subsidize a negotiation rent savings? I don't understand everything. Who must fight it for that? Is it personal thing? Must do that? I want to try this on that one. And on the development of skills then inside. So
just want to know, I think it's excellent, that sort of inmate. You indicated that as of the 30th of September 2012, 3,102 inmates were sorted. Did you determine what the reason for those assaults was? And secondly, how many officials were assaulted in the same period?
Okay, I'd like to thank Wayne to bring up the restorative justice aspect. I mean, Necro is just a hindsight in my part, being a passionate believer of restorative justice. I think I was focusing so much on the evidence-based practice, and true, there's a gap in terms of restorative justice. That's true. And Necro, we use restorative justice all the time. And we work with families as well as we work with victims. That is our key work when it comes to, and yes, they are key to deal with, even when we're dealing with family conflict and bullying, as well as working with victims. We're working with an interesting model with another organization called Prison Care and Support Network that works with the individual, then works with the family, and then works with the victim, because it's a process that you need to go through. We're also dealing with one case now where there's a victim who was raped 20 years ago, and she was raped and shot and stuck in a toilet. And her husband is in Ankara at the moment and negotiating, and she's ready to meet with her family. This is something that has been associated with me. So I thank you both for my, I thought it was here somewhere, but I think it's in my comprehensive presentation. I think it's in the PowerPoint. So you will find it there. So what, thank you. I think it's a key, and it has been, it's a key tool for problem solving, for people to build relationships, and it's key to reintegration and rehabilitation. So I thank you for using that. With regard to paying for offenders looking for housing, I did say that this was the social exclusion unit of the UK, and those were some of the responses they used. And I didn't really talk to her, and I should have talked to how practically we can implement it or not in the South African context. I think that's specifically what the UK did when it came to them identifying those socially excluded factors. Mr. Max, those 331 inmates that were taken from either the annual report of the JICS or DCS documents. So I think I made reference to that. I didn't really look into it. I think that the annual report of JICS can respond to, because there is information there about it. But according to the DCS stats, I think they did some evaluation as of the 30th of September 2012, I don't know if they took it on the DIC step, but maybe DCA can answer that. Or if they did their own evaluation, because there's a lot of drinkers in the planning to, as of subject September 2012. So, yeah. So we need to...
Chairperson, you know, the reason why I'm asking this question, because a soul of an inmate is totally wrong. A necessary soul is wrong. An unlawful soul is wrong. But the focus is just one side. You know, it just focus on the inmate. Whatever the inmate is saying and believed and blah, blah. On the other hand, I mean, we were witnesses. Our officials bleed and seriously stabbed by the very same. But newspaper clips and all these things is just a one, two line. But once it's on the other side, to the balance there. So, if one looks at 3,132, then obviously there might be a link between assault and a, not an event, but a reaction. Not to say that it's unnecessary. This is not what I would like to indicate. But I need there a fair balance between, and also a focus on the dangerous environment, because it's not angel inside. We talk here like it is angel. Look at TV, how they stand innocent people, you know, in their houses and all these things. We were also victims of crime. Not that you have to deal with them like dogs, but on the other hand, you have to be considerate of the fact. And they are not there before they're walking there, screaming in front of them. They were there before they, for those innocents convicted because of lack of wrong identification, whatever the case may be. But the majority are there because they are furious.
I agree with Mr. Max, and I think when I talk about correction officials, I do mention the environment, and I think we do need a balanced view of it. But there have been some incidents where there's been so-called torture and inhumane treatment, and thus need serious attention. But I agree with you. Maybe one needs to elaborate when one analyzes the assault issue and in context, because it's much more complex. Okay, can I say one more thing regarding halfway houses, if I may? I've got one of our partners here, Naomi Steph from Sabine. They're working in Oldmore Prison and doing a lot of work in the women's prisons and skills development programs. I think they have about 20 skills development programs. There's 20 running now in Oldmore Prison. And interestingly, I'm working with two halfway houses, Nicole. The one run by the Prison Care Support Network and another one by Pro Peace. And these are halfway house models, and very interesting models. Sabi is very much into skill development and that sort of thing. So the partnering approach is working very well. Somebody mentioned earlier about turning the halfway house into agricultural farming, Mr. Self. And we've got lots of plans to do that. Sabi basically trains officials, inmates in prison, they have this hairdressing salon or whatever. They ensure that the inmates, when they come up, get a job. Then the halfway house facility is provided where they receive rehabilitation, reintegration, no partnership approach, spiritual care, whatever. And then we've got a plan where inmates are paying towards their keep. It's a process of 6 to 12 months to facilitate reintegration, family programs. So we hope to research that. But to say that we went to the DCS and they did not have money to support such an initiative. So they are NGO halfway houses running without the support of the Department of Correctional Services. But nevertheless, we believe we want to establish a network of half-hour houses that it would include all DCS supported and other, so that we can learn from one another in terms of what works and how we can incorporate evidence-based practices. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Thank you very much, Nicola, and everybody else. You've come to the end of at least being informed by yourself in preparation for our two-day session of the department tomorrow. And Thursday, and also in preparation for our budget speech on the 29th, which all of you are welcome. I think it's a 2 o'clock in each of tonight, but I'm sure you guys will get that information. This is one thing that maybe one day we need to discuss. And I'm raising it because you've raised it, I've raised it before. About it, yes, because the media and other people might think it's controversial, but I truly believe that sometimes you
time over exaggerates the family involvement in rehabilitation. I truly believe you over exaggerate. First of all, it's not practical. You see, because if you're saying that family rehabilitation is necessary, you're going to find people in Kopenhagen that don't have a prison in Kopenhagen, but the nearest prison is in Amtata. So what are you saying about those people? I can tell you that just last week I received a call suddenly from one of the people that we house transfer from Mpumalanga. Mpumalanga is Barberton. We have an inmate transferred from Barberton to Johannesburg on the insistence of the family because it's too difficult to get there, they don't have money. I kid you not, Vanessa, the last week, Sunday, the mother phoned me and said, Mr. Smith, you helped us get X from Barberton to here. Now he's here. He's terrorizing us because they live in Arapapa. He is now terrorizing us, in fact, to the effect that he says when he comes up, both me, the mother, and the girlfriend, he's going to kill us. Now, this is after we took, not your advice, but because we have the thing that if you're near home, it's what you want. He is terrorizing, and I said to you, unfortunately, to have a prison has got cell phones, you can, in fact, they've got these walkers, you see the small TVs, I'm saying this to you guys, these small TVs that they have nowadays, they have those type of things that some people. But this guy has a cell phone. He's phoning, terrorizing the mother and the girlfriend. This after we brought him from Mpumalanga to Johannesburg. So, I just think sometimes you guys are over exaggerating this thing of family. And let me, and I said this earlier, I mean, that was my motivation before. In our house, there's two boys. For my sons, I was sent to boarding school from a very young age. My brother went to Coney High. I'm telling you, if you put two of us here now, it'll be chalk and cheese. Your argument would be that a brother went to Coney High because he was at home should be a greater model of a human being than this one that was not at home. If you put that together, it's chalk and cheese. And I can tell you that most people in Johannesburg that went to boarding school are better people than those that stayed at home. So this argument of family being a source of rehabilitation, personally I don't like. I'm arguing that we rather have a center of expertise. Now, I'd rather send my son from Johannesburg to Kimberley if I know that when he comes out of there, he's going to be a well man. Then to have him in Sun City, when I know coming out of there, he will be a worse somebody. Because I know what Sun City looks like. So, I'm just raising it. I know you are the thing is Vanessa, but I really am just saying that, guys, you must have to discuss it. Because inmates pick this thing up, and they actually abuse it. So then I get reports every day of people saying, I'm in Pretoria, I want to go to Tiago. I'm in wherever, because we were told that I would be next to my family. Every day we get those type of things. And I'm just saying that at some point you need to read this white paper. This argument of being close to home is something that I think about. We must have a debate on. Because whether you come from the Eastern Cape, or just survive in Joba, or somebody comes, why must it be for teenagers that you must be close to family?
But Chair, we need intervention. I'm not just saying that they should be close to their family. What you've just said now motivates the intervention. Because that guy was terrorizing, we could do a process with that. Because what happens when he does kill them, or he does come out and that happens? So what I'm saying is not just having families close, it's doing an intervention with them. That's key.
Alright, once again, thank you. We always enjoy debating with you. Correctional Services, we see you tomorrow for two or three of your programs. We see you Thursday for another two or three of your programs. We meet after lunch members tomorrow and after lunch on Thursday. But if you can finish it all tomorrow, then you are free on Thursday. Really give us a lot. Before you leave? See? Put it at the back. Okay. All right, can all members remain for 2 seconds? Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen.